Support for WPR comes from Northwind Renewable Energy Cooperative, dedicated to offering solar power solutions and electric vehicle charging for governments, schools, and nonprofits in central Wisconsin. NorthwindRE.com.
The Ideas Network.
This is Old Time Radio Drama. Good evening. I'm Norman Gilliland, and we'll have our Name That Sound contest for you in a minute. Your chance to win a prize from Old Time Radio Drama this Sunday night. Comedy from George Burns and Gracie Allen, and you are there going to put you to a place called New Amsterdam back in the 17th century. Philo Vance with a case tonight, calling all cars with true-to-life police action from the 30s, and Rogues Gallery with that alter ego of Richard Rogues, and it's all, of course, Dick Powell. I'm Norman Gilliland, and good evening, Michelle.
Good evening, Norman.
You're here, I'm here. That means there must be a mystery sound in the air tonight.
There is.
All right, well, I'll give you the phone number and the email address to send in your guesses for the next roughly 20 minutes or so for our Name That Sound contest and see what you can make of that. Maybe you'll win the prize tonight. You can email your identification of our mystery sound to us at oldtimeradio@wpr.org, or you can phone 1-800-642-1234. Okay, so you give that one
too again. Too many numbers, yeah.
Too many places, too many numbers. 1-800-642-1234. If you can name that sound.
Pretty easy one, I think.
Made live in our studio. Okay, well, I hope it's not ice skating. I don't know. Some days it's like that. All right, give us that again. All right, there you go. If you can identify that mystery sound the next 20 minutes or so during the duration of Gunsmoke, give us a call or send us an email. 1-800-642-1234 or oldtimeradio@wpr.org. And now with a plot twist worthy of the Whistler, and maybe I've said too much already, we go out to Dodge and Gunsmoke in a story called Devil's Hindmost from January 6th, 1957.
Gunsmoke. Around Dodge City and in the territory on West, there's just one way to handle the killers and the spoilers, and that's with a U.S. Marshal and the smell of gun smoke. Gunsmoke, starring William Conrad. The story of the violence that moved west with young America. And the story of a man who moved with it.
I'm that man. Matt Dillon, United States Marshal. The first man they look for and the last they want to meet. It's a chancy job, and it makes a man watchful. And a little lonely.
You know, Mr. Dillon, it's pretty doggone funny when you stop to think about it.
What is, Chester?
Life is.
No? You, been reading another book?
Well, yes, sir, I have. It's one Doc lent me. It was wrote by some fellow named Shakespeare. Did you ever hear of him, Mr. Dillon?
Shakespeare?
Yes, sir. Pretty well known in his day, I guess. He died, though, quite a while back, according to Doc.
Yeah, so I understand, Chester.
He don't use English too good. He's one of them foreigners, so it makes it kind of hard to follow him, you know. But I'll say one thing, Mr. Dillon. He sure does call the turn on the way people act.
Is that so?
Why, the things that was going on over there in Europe and all them cities in the olden days, it's just the same as what modern folks are doing here in Dodge right now.
You don't say.
Why, they were scheming and plotting and lying to one another just the same as now.
Then at least things aren't getting any worse, huh?
Every time a person turned around, somebody was killing somebody, seemed like. Used swords and knives, mostly. It appears they didn't have no guns to speak of back then.
Stay out!
Wait a minute.
Don't come back here again unless you're sober.
Well, that's Buck Weber, Mr. Dillon.
Yeah. Come on.
Back here. I'll show you if I'll come back here doing that.
Hello, Buck.
Marshal?
What seems to be the trouble?
No trouble, Marshal. No trouble at all.
No. If Sam Noonan was to throw me out of the Long Branch, I'd call it trouble.
He didn't have no cause to.
Well, he must have thought he did. Sam's a pretty fair man, ordinarily.
I wasn't doing nothing. I just wanted to see Rancy was all.
Rancy? What's she doing in there?
She's working. What do you think a woman would be doing in there?
Your wife's working on the Long Branch?
3 days ago, she took some of her things and come into town. She said she was leaving the farm. She was leaving me. Wouldn't come back no more.
Well, Buck, you know how a woman is. She'll say a lot of things when she's mad.
Now, Rancy, she ain't like that. She meant it, Marshal. And I ain't even gonna let her do it.
Well, I'll give her some rope. She'll cool off in a few days, maybe.
No, with that tin-horned gambler hanging around her, she won't. I'm going back there and kill that no good.
Wait a minute, Buck. Wait a minute now. Sam told you to stay out, and from the shape you're in, I think maybe he's right.
What do you mean, the shape I'm in?
Well, you had a little too much to drink, I think. Come on, let's take a walk, huh?
I want to walk.
Take his other arm, Chester.
Yes, sir.
I want to go back there and talk to the ranch.
Come on. It'll keep.
It'll keep, all right. That slick-talking gambler hanging around filling her full of lies.
Which gambler? What do you mean?
Well, that Frisco Bates. He's been in there every night since she started. Talking soft to her. Trying to give her doubts about her rightful place in the world.
She must have had a few doubts already, Buck, or she wouldn't have left you.
Carrying on the way she is with that Frisco Bates. Everybody laughing at me. I'm going back there and kill her.
Wait, no, you're not. No, you're not. Now, come on. That's it. That's it.
Whole town talking behind my back.
Well, a funeral wouldn't give them any less to talk about, you know.
You take me to jail, Marshal?
Not just for tonight, Buck. It's the only way to keep you out of trouble.
Which side are you on, anyhow? Mine or that no good gambler's?
Maybe neither one, Buck. There's another side to it.
Whose?
Your wife's.
Do you think you should leave politics to the politicians? Well, I'm sure some politicians would like this. But tell me, are you the sort of guy who thinks taxes are too high? Do you like the way your city is kept up? Do you think there should be more parks, perhaps a lot more sandlots for baseball or football? You say you do or don't like the foreign aid program? Well, our government was designed to give you a voice. You'd be surprised at how influential a letter or a wire is to your congressman or senator. You should protect your right to be heard by voting. As the Athenian Pericles said, we do not say that a man who takes no interest in politics minds his own business. We say he has no business here at all. Unquote. Take an interest in politics. It is your business. This is one definition in our Dictionary of Freedom.
You might be going to pass us up this evening.
That's hard to break the habit. Kitty, I understand Rancy Weber's working here now.
That's right, Matt. She started 3 nights ago.
Is she around?
She'll be back in a minute. Right now, she's crying.
Oh?
Yeah, her husband came in drunk and mad a while ago and started abusing her.
Yeah, I know. I just locked him up for the night.
I'm glad you did, Matt. Buck Weber could be real mean if he got started.
I'm afraid he's already started, Kitty. What about this Frisco Bates?
Oh, so that's it. I told Ramsey to talk and get around.
Anything to it?
I don't think so. Not really.
Buck's got the idea there is.
Well, he's a touchy one, Matt. He's awful hard to figure.
Yeah, I know.
I hated to see Ramsey start here, but she told me she'd left him. She didn't have a cent to her name.
Uh-huh.
I thought she might be better off here than some of the other places. At least I can sort of look after her.
I'm sorry, Kitty. I shouldn't have acted like that. Oh, good evening, Marshal.
How are you, Ramsey?
Oh, if you two will excuse me, I better look after a couple of things.
Yeah, sure, Kitty.
I guess you're probably kind of surprised to find me working in a place like this.
No, I'd already heard about it. I saw your husband a little while ago.
Oh.
You, sure you know what you're doing, Ramsey?
I'm sure, Marshal.
It's an easy life to get into, but it's rough to get out of.
So is farming.
And I'm afraid Buck's going to cause you trouble.
He's caused me trouble for 7 years.
Is that so?
7 years of drudgery. Make a woman a slave and work her to death. Never a decent word.
You know, some of the easy ways work out hard, too, Ramsey.
Well, I take my chances. But Buck might as well get it through his head right now. I'm not going back, not ever.
I doubt if Buck's going to see it that way.
He has to. What can he do about it?
Well, he could try to harm you, maybe, in some way.
I'll let him. It won't be the first time. There's nothing Buck likes better than hitting a woman. Unless maybe it's a young one.
Well, right now he seems to want to hit a fellow named Frisco Bates.
Oh, Mr. Bates, he's just been kind to me. That's all.
Uh-huh. You know, men like him are new to you, Ramsey. They can cause a lot of trouble sometimes. Just by being kind.
I'm not a bad woman, Marshal. At least I don't think I am. All I ask is just a little kindness and a reason to laugh once in a while. Is that too much?
Not to ask, no. Sometimes a little too much to expect, though.
Are you going to monopolize this young lady all evening, Marshal?
Oh, how are you? Let's go. Ramsey, you better go see what it was that Kitty wanted, huh?
Well, Kitty...
Yeah.
All right, Marshal. You excuse me, Mr. Bates?
Certainly.
Is this a policy of the law in Dodge City, Marshal, interfering in people's personal affairs?
Sometimes, yeah. At least when their personal affairs seem to be heading toward a killing.
You mean Ramsey's husband, I suppose.
And he came around looking for you, didn't he?
The way he's been treating her, I may go looking for him.
Why her, Frisco? There are other women around.
Not like Ramsey.
She's out of place here. She's not the kind to be working here. You know it.
Maybe she won't be long. I've asked Ramsey to go away with me, Marshal. I've asked her to marry me. Does that surprise you?
A little bit, yeah.
It surprised me, too. But that's the way it is.
Ramsey agree to it?
Not yet. But she will. Buck Weber won't have a thing to say about it.
He won't, huh? I wouldn't count on that if I were you.
Many a child has been warned by his parents that if he digs too deep a hole in the flower bed, he's liable to fall through to China. Well, apparently this little tale had its origin in our American folklore many years ago. And it all started when Captain Wentworth bumped into the great Sam Patch in the middle of the China Seas. The captain said, "Why, Sam, how did you get here?
I thought you were drowned near the Canadian border.
Sam replied,
I didn't get here at all. I dove right through. In that there Niagara dive, I went so deep, I thought it was just a short to come up the other side. So I came out here in the China Seas. Now you just turn your ship around and I'll race you back to Boston. And if I don't beat you, then my name's not Sam Patch.
Folklore belongs to every nation's legendary past, and I guess we Americans have our share of some tall tales.
Buck.
Marshal.
Did you sleep all right?
Tolerable.
Well, I hope you slept off some of those crazy notions you had last night.
Maybe.
All right, come on out. I got your belongings out here in the office, Buck. There's no charge against you. You're free to leave.
Glad to hear that, anyway.
Morning, Buck.
Stuff's there on the table, Buck.
Thanks. Did I get my gun back?
Chester?
I'll get it. There you are, Buck.
What are your plans?
Well, I reckon I better ride back out home and take care of the chores. Stocks used to be in Fed a couple hours earlier than this.
Not what I meant, Buck. What about Rancy?
I ain't rightly made up my mind yet, Marshal.
Leave her alone, will you? Give her a chance to use her own judgment.
Don't seem like she's got much of that. From the folks she's took up with the last few days.
It's her own business. She's a grown woman.
She's a married woman, too. She hadn't ought to be carrying on the way she is.
She hasn't done anything wrong.
I ain't saying she is. I got nothing against Rancy. Any woman's liable to get out of hand once in a while and start thinking fancy. I get her back out there in the farm for a week or two, she'll come to her senses.
Uh-huh.
Just that Frisco that's causing all the trouble, trying to turn her head.
As far as I can see, all he's doing is treating her with a little respect.
It's a matter of opinion, Marshal. Well, if the law's got no more dealings with me, I'll be getting on.
No dealings, Buck. Not right now, anyway.
Good. That fellow was born under a bad star, Mr. Dillon.
Yeah, you may be right, Chester.
He lives mad and he's gonna die mad. You just wait.
That's about all I can do, Chester.
You know, Matt, the best time of day is at night. I always look forward to it.
Oh, why so, Doc?
Because after dark, this flea-bit town doesn't look so goddamn ugly. That's why.
I see.
If a man puts his mind to it, he can even imagine he's someplace else.
Seems to me if a man really wanted to, he could pull up stakes and be someplace else.
Yeah, I don't know about that. A couple of years out on this blasted prairie leaves a man uncivilized for the rest of his life.
Doc, you were born uncivilized.
Oh, in medical school, I was regarded as a lad of culture and refinement.
Medical school? I always thought you had veterinary training.
I'd have been better off if I had. There's more animals around here than people. And that's not counting the people that are animals. Or just the same as, anyway.
Oh, they're improving a little bit year by year.
Oh, yeah, sure, they're improving. They're all for themselves, and the devil take the hindmost. That's what. Human nature doesn't change, man.
Well, that's what Chester thinks. Since you started him reading Shakespeare.
Yeah, it won't do him any harm.
Come on, Doc. It's over back of the Dodge House, I think.
Yeah, you say civilized, huh? Oh, sure, yeah. Yeah, improving. People shooting each other all the time, and bullets flying around.
Come on over this way.
Yeah, sure. Nobody dying in their beds. Oh, yes, sir. So much. Yeah.
Wow. Over here, Mr. Dillon.
Somebody fired through the window in the Frisco Bay crew. They must have been hiding out here in the dark somewhere.
All right, come on. We can get in through the back door.
Yes, sir.
Will you stand back, please? Stand away from the door, will you? All right, go on in, Doc. Chesterfield.
It's the first room, Mr. Dillon. Right here at the corner. Quiet, huh? For Mr. Dillon.
Well, good Lord, Matt.
Yeah. All right, take over, will you, Doc? I got some dealings with a man.
Nobody inside, Mr.
There's one way to find out. All right, hold it, Buck.
Why, Marshal, I thought I heard somebody knock.
You didn't. Been doing some shooting, huh?
No, I was just cleaning my gun. Sit down, Marshal. I'll clear this stuff off the table.
Never mind, Buck. Now let's have a look at that pistol.
What for?
Well, there have been three shots fired here.
Oh. Yeah, I forgot there was a coyote bothering around this morning.
There were three shots fired in town tonight back at the Dodge House.
That's so.
And a half a dozen people saw you running away from there right afterwards, Buck.
Why, I ain't been out of the house since dark.
Huh? And somebody's been riding one of your horses pretty hard, still lathered.
Don't say.
Way I figured, Buck, you waited outside Frisco's window till you saw the lamp lit and a shadow on the blind, then you fired through the window and ran for your horse. Is that about the way it was?
Yeah. Just about.
And you're under arrest for murder.
There won't nothing come of it, Marshal. When a man's wife's being bothered, there's an unwritten code.
There's no code about killing from ambush.
Well, you had it coming to him. The jury will see it that way. He was trying to get her to run away with him. Everybody in town knew about
it. They didn't know she'd made up her mind not to do it.
What do you mean?
She told Kitty tonight. And she went over to tell Frisco, but he wasn't in. The clerk of the Dodge House gave her the key to Frisco's room so she could go back and wait for him.
What are you saying, Marshal?
It was Rancy who lit that lamp tonight. It was her shadow on the blind.
Well, then I...
That's right, Buck. She's dead. And juries don't have much sympathy for men who kill women. You're gonna hang, Buck. Just as sure as shooting.
How well do you know the history of your Marine Corps? For example, did you know that the Marines were the first American troops to be decorated with the Fourragère, one of France's highest decorations of honor? In June 1918, the German Army was in possession of Belleau Wood, a highly strategic point on the way to Paris, and unless the wood was secured by the Allies, Paris would soon fall. Two regiments of the American 2nd Division, the 5th and 6th Marines, were deployed to the south of Belleau Wood and ordered to drive the German troops back. Although greatly outnumbered, the Marines attacked again and again, and within 3 weeks, Belleau Wood was secured for the Allies. After Belleau Wood, the Marines continued their valiant fight, and to them, the grateful French government awarded the Croix de Guerre with two palms and a gold star, and the first American troops to be so honored, the Foragère. Thus, another page was added to the history of your United States Marine Corps. Gunsmoke, produced and directed by Norman McDonald, stars William Conrad as Matt Dillon, U.S. Marshal. Featured in the cast were Parley Bear as Chester, Howard McNear as Doc, and Georgia Ellis as Kitty. George Walsh speaking. Join us again next week for another specially transcribed story on Gunsmoke. This is the United States Armed Forces Radio and Television Service.
With a plot twist worthy of the Whistler, that was Gunsmoke, Devil's Hindmost, and a story from January 6th, 1957. Sounded like the Perrin there in the part of the aggravated husband. He, Wisconsin Public Radio alum. Well, we're going to have comedy from George Burns and Gracie Allen next, and the results of our Name That Sound contest right after this. You're listening to Old Time Radio Drama on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
There are 54,000 individuals and families who contribute to Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to their investment, you can hear your favorite programs and discover new ones all over Wisconsin and beyond. Thank you. Support also comes from Club Pilates, offering group Pilates classes for all ages and all skill levels, with locations downtown, the west side of Madison, and Sun Prairie. Information is available at clubpilates.com.
All right, we'll find out what our mystery sound is. Very popular mystery tonight.
Very.
I have to admit, you know, many correct solutions there, mm-hmm. as you predicted, Michelle, which is just fine.
So here we go.
So the next time you're in a nasty scrape, name that sound and maybe you'll win a prize.
Grab that sandpaper and just do it. And this person isn't our winner, but Paul from Arcadia thought it was 100 grit or better. Okay, it's actually 220. So
well, good shout job, out to him.
Paul.
Yeah, talk about naming that sound.
But our winner is Rick S. from Appleton.
All right. And if Rick S. from Appleton will call back, we will send him one of our Wisconsin Public Television travel mugs. I think it has a train on it. And you can enjoy that whether you're in a train, a plane, or an automobile. All right. So now, to a real-life husband and wife couple who came out of vaudeville and made a big radio and television also, George Burns and Gracie Allen, and their guest star, you might say, or periodic cast member, Meredith Wilson, W-I-L-L-S-O-N, no slouch either, with many hit musicals to his credit, the music man foremost among them. This is another one of those scheming plots with Gracie trying to get the unreasonable. And our story comes to us from January 17th, 1946.
It's Maxwell House Coffee Time, starring George Burns and Gracie Allen. With yours truly, Bill Goodwin, and the music of Meredith Wilson and his orchestra. For deep down laughs and listening enjoyment, it's George and Gracie. And for deep down coffee drinking enjoyment, it's Maxwell House. With extra flavor in the blend because of choice Latin American coffees skillfully combined. Extra flavor in the cup because Radiant Roast develops the full flavor of every coffee bean. And the result is that today more people buy Maxwell House than any other brand of coffee in the world. Well, it's morning in the Burns home, and George has just come down to breakfast.
How about a little food, Dad?
All right, George. But first, there's something I'd like to ask you.
What?
Well, our radio show goes on this evening, and my club, the Beverly Hills Uplift Society, would like to take it over.
Oh, no. You sneaked those dames on the program last week, and they set radio back 50 years.
Oh, no, that's not fair, George. We simply made a few changes.
Some program. Everybody's laughing at me.
Well, you see, that's one of the changes we made.
Forget it.
But, George, the girls are simply dying to get on the air.
Then let them fly around with the other bats. That's my program, and it's going to stay my program.
Well, of course it is. We'll be on it, but you'll direct the whole thing.
Direct it?
Well, yes, because that takes brains, and you're the brainy one in this family. Why, compared to you, I'm only brilliant.
That's very flattering, but...
Your darling little head just bulges with brains.
Look,
That's what makes your ears stick out that way.
Thanks for the explanation,
but... I love being a director, George. We'll get you a chair with your name on it.
What am I supposed to do with that?
Well, you're supposed to sit in it. Of course, a man as clever as you might have a better idea.
Oh, sure.
And we'll get you a lovely desk with 10 telephones on it.
10 telephones?
Yes, a great executive needs at least 10. Suppose you can't make a long-distance call because of a telephone strike. You just make 10 short ones and add them together.
That's just convenient.
And the best feature is that you never come to the studio. You stay right here at home.
Gracie, the Beverly Hills Uplift Society is not taking over my program.
Oh, be progressive, George. Sooner or later, women are going to take over radio, and you can start the movement.
Nothing doing.
But your name will go down in history. People will always speak of you as that progressive George Burns. That clever progressive George Burns. That brilliant clever progressive George Burns. Dynamic? Simulating? No program.
No program, no. And not only do I want those dames kept off my program, but I want them kept out of my house.
Yes, dear. Mm.
Every time they meet here, they come into the kitchen before I awake and gobble up all the bacon and eggs.
Yes, dear.
And now I'm ready for breakfast.
Yes, dear. What would you like?
Bacon and eggs and a piece of toast.
I'll get you a piece of toast.
You mean...
They're in the den.
In the den, yes. Well, get those dames out or I'll throw them out.
You can't, George. Meredith Wilson rents the den, and he said we could meet there.
Yeah, the poor jerk lets you meet in his room because you laugh at his terrible jokes. Why, you women even... You even took him into your club.
Well, it was perfectly legitimate. We made him an honorary woman.
Okay, you run along and break that meeting up as soon as you can. I'll fix my toast and have a piece of cheese with it.
Oh, that reminds me. Our new member, Madame de Silva, doesn't like bacon and eggs.
Don't tell me she ate the cheese.
Uh-huh. I'll see you later, dear. Quiet, girl. Quiet, please.
Well, Gracie, did you talk George into staying home so we could take over the program again?
Well, no, girls. I'm sorry to report that Plan A, making him think he was an intelligent director, didn't work.
Oh, dear. What are we going
to do? Unfortunately, he was a little too smart to believe that he was intelligent.
Oh, what a shame. We had such a cultural half hour all prepared.
Yes. I was going to sing 30 or 40 songs.
Well, fellow members, I guess it's up to me to clear away the gloom with a little joke. I got a pipperoo about brides, if someone would care to mention the subject of brides.
It's your turn, Madame de Silva.
Very well. Many years ago, I was a bride.
Ha! Speaking of brides, I'm a recently married gentleman who said to his bride, sweetheart, there's something wrong with this pudding you have prepared for me. Whereupon the perplexed bride responded, there can't be. The cookbook says it's perfectly delicious.
Is that the finish, Meredith?
Yes.
All right, girls, let's show our appreciation.
I knew it was a pipperoo.
Now, girls, There must be some way to keep George out of the studio this evening so we can put on our show. Plan A was a failure, so let's get to work on Plan B. Any suggestions?
We might give him something to make him dopey.
Nature beat us to that one.
Any other suggestions? All right, girls, then it's settled. Plan B will definitely be the bathtub plan.
Well, hello, Uplifter.
Hello, Bill.
Say, George says you girls are trying to get him off the radio program again. How come?
We don't want any men on the program.
Oh, now, wait a minute. You can't get rid of me, you know. I represent the sponsor. You can't go on the air without me.
Say, that's right. How can we get around this?
Well, there's only one way. We'll have to make Bill an honorary woman, too. Then he can join our club.
Oh, no. I don't want to be a woman. Not me.
But women have lots of fun, Bill. Don't the women who go out with you have fun?
Well, sure, but that's just it. And if I'm a woman, I won't be able to take myself out. And if I can't go out with me, what's the fun of being a woman?
Oh, Bill, won't you change your mind? You like being a woman. Sure you will.
Oh, come on, be a woman.
Yes, join us, Bill.
Speaking as one who has just recently become an honorary woman, I can recommend it.
You can, Meredith?
Yes. As you know, I used to be very shy and bashful around women. But after 1 week of being around the Uplifters, other women don't frighten me at all.
That I can understand.
Then you refuse to become an honorary woman? You won't join our team?
Oh, no, Gracie. If I join your team, it'll spoil all my scrimmaging.
Well, very well. Blanche, as vice president in charge of blackmail, can you dig a little persuader out of your file?
I think I have some interesting data on Mr. Goodwin.
Oh, no, not that again.
Here we are, December 10th. Bill Goodwin gave an engagement ring to a beautiful redhead named Patricia Ryan.
Oh, so that's her last name. I wondered about that.
On that same day, Bill Goodwin also gave engagement rings to the following girls: Elizabeth Jones, Florence Riley, Mary Edith Stahl, Natalie Galen, Ruth Henning, and Geraldine Bojo.
Well, now, wait a minute. If those girls find out that I have more than one fiancé, I'll be in hot water.
Hand me the phone, Blanche. I'll light the fire.
Have a heart, Gracie. Natalie Galen's father's a big game hunter. He'll shoot me.
Don't worry. You look very fetching on the wall of his den.
Yes, you'll be the first Hollywood wolf ever stuffed.
Okay, you got me. I'll join your club.
Oh, good. Here's a copy of the Beverly Hills Uplift Society Oath of Allegiance. Now raise your right hand and read it.
Holy smoke, this is going to change my whole life. On my honor, I do solemnly swear that henceforth women will come first with me. This is going to be as big a change as I thought.
Please, madam, this is a solemn occasion.
I do hereby agree to share with my sister members of the club any and all treasures, such as my beauty secrets, silk undies, and pre-war girdles. Oh, now, wait a minute, Gracie. I don't have to swear to that, do I?
Well, no, I guess not.
Good. I don't mind sharing the beauty secrets, but I'm running awful low on the other two.
Lead on.
And last, I do hereby declare that my great objective in life shall be that of every woman. Oh, no, I can't read this.
Hand me the phone, Blanche.
Okay. My great objective in life shall be that of every woman, motherhood.
Congratulations, Bill, old man. Old girl.
Well, now that Bill is a full-fledged member of the Beverly Hills Uplift Society, he can help us put across Plan B.
What's Plan B?
That's our next plan, to keep George from showing up at the radio broadcast so we can take it over.
Yes, under Plan B, George winds up in the bathtub and all his clothes are gone.
Oh, Gracie, that's a low, mean trick. That's underhanded stuff. Surely we wouldn't do a thing like that.
He hasn't been a woman very long, has he?
And
now here's Meredith Wilson and his chiffon arrangement of Carolina Moon. Don't you think when folks hear that familiar strain, just about everybody knows what you're playing?
Oh, I'm sure they do, Bill. I think practically everyone knows Carolina Moon.
Yes, the name Carolina has found its way into American hearts through familiar American music, just as the Carolinas themselves have been such a familiar part of the American scene through the years. Virginia Dare, Sir Walter Raleigh, Roanoke Island, the Appalachian and Blue Ridge Mountains are only a few of the names that come to us from the colorful history of the Carolinas. I can't help thinking, too, how today there's another name that's become part and parcel of our American scene, of so many American homes. It's the name Maxwell House, signifying a coffee blend of true distinction, combining these fine Latin American coffees. Manizales for mellowness. Medellins for richness. Other choice Latin American coffees for vigor. And Bucaramangas for full body. So it's no wonder that the famous name Maxwell House is known all over this great land of ours for full-flavored, fine coffee. Good to the last drop. Now, let's go back to the Burns home where Plan B, to keep George off the radio program, is being launched by Gracie. Under this plan, she gets George into the bathtub and swipes his clothes. Personally, I don't see how she's going to do it, but you know Gracie.
So won't you come into the den and sing for the girls, George? They're waiting to hear your glorious voice.
You sure this isn't a trick to get me off the program?
Get you off the program? Why, we want you to sing for the entire half hour.
Don't you want to broadcast culture?
We do. And what could be more culture than your voice? Why, you give the world a pearl of melody every time you open the oyster of your mouth.
Well...
Come on, darling. The girls are waiting to hear you sing.
Okay, I'll give them a little thrill.
Here he is, gal. The Nightingale of Beverly Hills. Sugar Throat Burns.
Any special requests?
Oh, singing, Mr. Haven. I'm sure all the girls will swoon when they hear that, won't you, girls?
Okay. Ain't Miss Haven. Wait a minute, I wasn't singing yet.
And now for his next number, Mr.
Next Burns. Number? I didn't do my first ditty.
For his next number, Mr. Burns will sing something which I know will be especially thrilling to our own classical singer, Madame de Silva. Short and breath.
But have you started, ain't Miss Behaven?
Short and breath for Madame de Silva.
Mammy's little baby love, shortening. Mammy's little baby love, shortening breath. Mammy.
Mammy's lady. Mammy's little baby.
Control your ecstasy.
That was not the ecstasy.
What?
It was joy, dear. That's much louder than ecstasy. Why, you're better than Nelson Eddy.
You really think
yes,
so?
Yes, certainly, and much more convincing. Why, when you sang Shortening Bread, I could actually smell it.
The same goes for Ain't Misbehavers. Gracie, listen, how does this get him into the bathtub so we can grab his clothes?
You'll see. Yes, girls, my husband was magnificent, but you haven't heard anything until you hear him sing in the bathtub.
Oh, I see.
Well, it's true. The bathtub seems to give my voice an added resonance and depth.
Yeah, why don't you jump right in now, darling?
Well, I've had one bath today, but I like baths.
Good.
I guess I'm just a caveman at heart. Makes me feel good to get rid of my clothes for a while.
Yes, well, this bath is going to keep you happy for a long time.
Okay, now listen closely, girls. I may hit a high C. Mammy's little baby.
Okay, girls, our objective is in sight. As soon as he gets into the tub, we'll get all his clothes. Blanche, you take his other suits from the closet.
All right.
Clara, you take his shirts and ties.
Okay.
Master Silva, you bring his shoes and socks.
But Gracie, what if he wraps a towel around himself and chases it?
Oh, don't worry. There isn't a towel in the house that'll go all the way around George. Now, hurry, we'll meet at Bill Goodwin's house in 5 minutes.
Good afternoon, Mrs. Burns. I've been ringing your door buzzer a long time. You look awfully old and tired today, Mrs. Burns.
I'm not Mrs. Burns. I'm Mr. Burns.
But you're wearing a dress.
I know I'm wearing a dress. It's all the clothes I could find.
My goodness, I didn't know the shortage of men's clothes was that bad.
Look, Mr.
I hope the returning servicemen won't have to wear dresses. The poor fellas won't know who's whistling at who.
You don't understand, Mr. Porter. I have clothes, but my wife's club, the Beverly Hills Uplift Society, took them.
But why?
Why? They want to take over my radio program. Naturally, I can't do a broadcast in just my underwear.
You're right. Let's not kill television before it gets started.
Well, those dames haven't outsmarted me. I called NBC and told them not to let any women into my studio tonight.
A shrewd move.
It certainly is a shrewd move. We can't let women get the upper hand. We men are the masters, and we're going to stay the masters.
Your dreams are getting better all the time.
Well, so long, Mr. Postman. See you later.
Goodbye, Mr. Burns.
What was that for?
That short dress shows your legs.
Not bad, huh?
I wish my wife had legs like yours.
Really?
Yes. Then when she got after me, I could run between them and escape. Well, goodbye. Remember, keep smiling.
Well, girls, are you all comfortable?
Oh, yes. Charming little place you have, Bill.
Oh, thanks.
I like the way your walls are simply covered with pictures. There must be hundreds of them.
Well, yes, but they're not so good. I'm having some better ones taken next week.
Now that you're one of us, Bill, we can tell you that taking over George's program is only the beginning.
Really?
Oh, yes. According to our plan, women will gradually take over all the programs.
Well, but how can women fill the place of singers like Crosby and Sinatra and Haynes?
Oh, that's easy. The place taken by all three of them can be filled by Kate Smith alone.
You're so right.
But you'll have to replace the classical singers, too, Gracie. What about John Charles Thomas?
We'll replace those three with the Andrew sisters.
You're really crowding the men right out of the picture.
Yes, and then the Old Maids of America will sponsor a quiz program for male contestants. If any man misses a question, he has to marry one of the sponsors.
And the questions won't be easy.
Yes. Isn't that a wonderful plan?
Man.
We'll call the program Take It and Love It.
Gracie, suppose the guy isn't happy with her.
Well, then he can tell his problem to Madam Anthony.
You certainly have figured all the angles.
Yeah, we're tired of it being a man's world.
And when we women take over radio, it'll be run smoothly and efficiently. No quarrels, no jealousies, no dissension.
Sounds great.
Yes, let's decide what each of us will do on the program this evening, huh? Madam De Silva, what will you contribute?
I intend to sing the bell song from Lakme. Why don't you sing a song about the Liberty Bell, dear?
Why? Would that suit my voice better?
Yes, it has a crack in it.
Why? You stone-deaf ignoramus!
Item one, solo by Madame De Silva. Now, what will you contribute, Clara?
Well, I thought I'd give a talk on fashion trends. I design all my own clothes, you know.
Did you design that peculiar garment that you're wearing?
Yes, and what's peculiar about it?
It resembles a tent pitched by a very young Boy Scout.
Oh, why, you jolly old frump!
Item two, fashion talk by Clara Baggins. Now, what about you, Blanche?
I'll give a Shakespearean recitation. You? Why not? When I was a girl, I learned everything Shakespeare wrote. When you were a girl, he hadn't written much. Why, you illiterate hillbilly.
Item three, Shakespearean recitation by Blanche Morton. Now, you see how smoothly we settle things, Bill?
Yeah, I'm fascinated.
Well, let's run through the opening. Bill, you read the announcement.
Okay, Gracie. Presenting the Beverly Hills Uplift Society in radio's first all-woman program.
Ah, beautiful lady.
Women of the world, arise. Let us shake off the chains of slavery and build a better world. A world in which there will be no men, just women and children. And now, for this evening's first tidbit of culture, here's Blanche Morton with a Shakespearean recitation.
The quality of mercy is not strained. It drops as a gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath it is twice less. It's less of him that gives than him that takes. It's mightiest of the mightiest.
Mrs. Morton, please, who would listen to that?
Well, I guess you could do it better.
Well, certainly. Listen to this. The quality of Maxwell House is tops. It poureth from the fragrant coffee pot into the cup beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesseth him that pours and him that drinks. 'Tis tastiest of the tastiest. Now, you see, people will listen to that because it's familiar to them. They know that Maxwell House is appetizing, rich, full-bodied, mellow coffee at its full-flavored best. Good to the last drop.
But those are not the words of William Shakespeare, the bard of Stratford-on-the-Avon?
No, those are the words of William Goodwin, the bard of Maxwell-on-the-House. And believe me, those words are known everywhere because more people buy and enjoy Maxwell House than any other brand of coffee in the world. Why, everybody who... Come in.
Good afternoon, Mr. Goodwin. Here's your mail.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Postman. Oh, say, I guess you're kind of surprised to find a dozen women in my house.
Yes, that's not as many as usual.
Mr. Postman, I don't suppose you saw anyone at my house.
Oh, I saw your husband, Mrs. Burns.
Well, how could that be? You couldn't see the tub from the front door.
Yes, I could. He's the one who opened it. He was wearing one of your dresses.
Oh, well, come on, girls. Let's get to the studio and do the broadcast.
Yeah. Oh, just a moment, ladies. I'm afraid it's no use. Mr. Burns told NBC that no women were to be allowed in his studio tonight.
Oh, well, that does it. Well, we might as well take George's clothes back to... George's clothes? That's it. We'll put on his clothes and walk right in.
But, Gracie, even in a suit, my figure won't look like a man.
Well, we'll pad you a little, dearie.
Now, just a minute.
The girls, hurry and put on George's suit. We'll go to the studio as men.
Well, goodbye, fellow. Well, whatever you are, remember, keep smiling.
Now, look, Mr. Poston, I know you've got orders not to let any women into Studio D, but I'm not a woman.
Now, beat it, sister.
Look, I've got on my wife's dress because my clothes were stolen. I'm a man.
With them hips?
Honest, I'm George Burns.
Oh, sure, and I'm Lauren Bacall. You ain't crashing this gate, sister.
I tell you, I'm George Burns, and if I don't get...
Well, good evening, Mr. Doorman.
Evening, Mr. Wilson.
Meredith, you're just in time. Oh, no. It's Gracie and the Uplifters. And they're wearing my suits.
You really are screwy, sister.
Honest, all those men are women. The little fellow in the green suit is my wife.
These are new members of my orchestra, Mr. Doorman. Mr. Morton?
Trombone.
Mr. Bagley?
Bass drum.
Mr. De Silva?
Zither.
And Mr. Allen?
Pipe organ.
Okay, gents, go right on through.
Gracie, you can't do this to me.
One side, madam. We have a program to do.
Oh, this is the end.
Join us again next week when we'll all be back. George Burns, Gracie Allen, Meredith Wilson and his orchestra, and yours truly, Bill Goodwin.
Until next Thursday, then, good night and good luck from the makers of Maxwell House. America's number one brand of coffee. Always good to the last drop.
Gracie, I have a surprise for you. Next week, our guest star will be Kay Kaiser.
Oh, wonderful. When we make him an honorary woman, we'll have a Southern Belle in our club.
Oh, no. The Beverly Hills Uplift Society, not next week.
All right, dear. In honor of Kay Kaiser, we'll call ourselves the Bold Weevil Uplift Society.
Gracie, those dames will not be on the program, or my name is not George Burns.
Good night, Sam.
Good night, everybody.
Stay tuned to this station because Dinah Shore's open house is coming on in just a second. Dinah's special guest tonight is Rudy Valley.
Oh, goody, goody, jello pudding tonight. It tastes like grandma's only more so.
You ain't kidding, that's right.
And just as jello, six delicious, lofty flavors can't be beaten. So the proof of jello pudding's in the eating.
The jello twins are hard to find, but keep on looking in your store. When sugar shortages are over, there'll be more.
Just a taste of jello pudding or a jello, and you know it's the one and only J-E-L-L-O.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
The George Burns and Gracie Allen Show from January 17th, 1946. Gracie with another one of her crazy schemes. And, of course, Gracie Allen, oh, when she went on, I think it was Information Please, she just, like, pegged all the meters. A very... intelligent woman.
Smart woman.
Playing a part, of course.
And the Jell-O twins.
The Jell-O twins. Yeah, I was trying to visualize the Jell-O twins, but they were there and bringing the show on the air for you for some time. Also a sponsor for Jack Benny. Not too many years off from that. Well, we're going to, speaking of years, take you all the way back to 1664. It's history in the making and you are there. right after this. You're listening to Old Time Radio Drama on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Join the conversation by emailing ideas at WPR.org and like us on Facebook at the Ideas Network.
Well, it was a clever idea, and they did it very well, too. CBS for a while, putting their news team back in history, covering a story. Some familiar, some not so familiar tonight. September 1st, 1664, as the British fleet approaches, are the Dutch going to surrender New Amsterdam? As they say, the rest is history. In this broadcast from January 22nd, 1950.
This is Bill Leonard at Fort Amsterdam, main defensive fortification on the southern tip of Manhattan Island. Here on this first day of September 1664, the little Dutch colony of New Netherlands faces its most critical hour. The English fleet is on the move. From where we are set up, high on the parapet of the fort, we can just about make out two of their ships. They appear to be through the narrows, well into New Amsterdam Harbor, headed upstream toward New Amsterdam under full sail and stripped for action. This village of New Amsterdam is in ferment. The question here, the unanswered question of the hour, is whether or not the Dutch governor, His Excellency Peter Stuyvesant, will accept the ultimatum of surrender delivered early this morning in a letter by a representative of the English commander-in-chief, Colonel Richard Nichols. Should the governor refuse to surrender Manhattan Island and all of the Dutch colony of New Netherlands, then within moments we may see this peaceful community of 1,500 souls turned into a battlefield. See the Bowery's and homes of these peace-loving burghers ripped and torn by the might of English cannon. It's just 8 in the morning here in New Amsterdam. A light haze that hung over the bay, the Toppen Zee, all morning has just lifted, and it gives promise of being a hot and humid day. From where we stand, the town looks deserted. Many people, under orders of Governor Peter Stuyvesant, are gathered at the northern...
September 1st, 1664. The English demand the surrender of New Amsterdam. You are there.
English men of war sail into the harbor of New Amsterdam, and Governor Peter Stuyvesant must make his choice between surrender and war. CBS takes you back 286 years to the decisive hour in the struggle of the Dutch to maintain their colonial empire on the mainland of North America. All things are as they were then, except for one thing. With all the modern facilities of radio present and CBS newsmen reporting from the scene,
You Are There.
You Are There is based on historical fact and quotation. And now?
1664. Fort Amsterdam at the southern tip of Manhattan Island and Bill Leonard.
Now to make out the two English frigates quite clearly. At the moment, they're quite a bit below Newton's, or Governor's Island, as it's more commonly called, and they're pressing forward toward our position here at Fort Amsterdam. The intention of the English is quite evident. Once these English ships sail past the fort here, if they can get beyond the fort, they can proceed up Hudson's River and take up their position anywhere along the exposed western flank of Manhattan Island. The only other point of defense here at New Amsterdam Island is along Het Single, where a wooden wall stretches from river to river about half a mile north of the fort. At this moment, while Governor Stuyvesant and his council are debating the English ultimatum in the government house here inside the fort, across town on the East River, a meeting of prominent citizens is in session in the Stadhuis, the town hall. A large body of workers on Het Single is reinforcing that position. Don Hollenbeck is up there with them. We take you now to Het Single, the street this side of the wall, and Don Hollenbeck.
Here on Het Single, an attempt is being made to repair the breastworks against the threatening invasion by English troops from the north. 5 days ago, on the first appearance of the English fleet off Coney Island,
Governor Stuyvesant issued an order to strengthen this barricade. It's actually nothing more than a wooden palisade that stretches across Manhattan Island. His order stated that all able-bodied men were to work in shifts on this project. Now, supervised by a company of Stuyvesant's troops, the burghers here are slowly putting up new palisades. A very few of them, are carrying timber. Some are digging post holes. But the most of the men are gathered in the shade of a grove of trees. They're smoking their long clay pipes. And despite the fact that they know of the approach of the English men of war, no one seems to have his heart in this project. There's a good deal of muttering and grumbling, and the people seem sullen and discouraged. All the talk you hear, centers on the letter. Somehow, for some reason, there seems to be a strong feeling here that the letter delivered to Governor Stuyvesant this morning by the English envoy, Governor John Winthrop of Connecticut, contains very easy, very desirable, very attractive terms. If Stuyvesant surrenders New Amsterdam to the English without a fight. Certainly the people here seem more interested in the contents of that letter than they are in preparing the defense of their town against the English. There's a lot of speculation, too, about the meeting of the prominent citizens of New Amsterdam now taking place at Stadhuis, the traditional meeting place of the burgomasters. For the latest developments on that point, we take you cross town now to Stadhuis on the East River and Douglas Edwards.
The clerk will read the next paragraph. We shall now examine
the news here. The big news is that the citizens' meeting in the main room of the town hall has just reached unanimous agreement to petition Governor Stuyvesant to surrender the colony to the English.
In this petition, it places us in the position of bondservants begging mercy of some lord. We are free.
As you probably hear, a remonstrance, a petition, is now being debated. It's being drawn up by all those in the hall. When the wording of this remonstrance is finally agreed on, a committee will be appointed to present the document to Governor Stuyvesant. A demand will also be made upon the governor to make public the contents of the letter.
We interrupt Doug Edwards to bring you the news that the English have landed in Brooklyn. I repeat, the English have landed in Brooklyn. A dispatch has just been received here telling us that a force of English soldiers from Colonel Nichols' fleet, estimated at between 2 and 500 men, has been put ashore close to the settlement of Brooklyn across the East River from us here in Manhattan. The report states that they are now marching northward to make contact with another English force on Long Island. The developing military situation is now becoming quite clear. Colonel Nichols is tightening a noose around Manhattan Island while, as we have reported, two of his heavily armed frigates are at this very moment speeding up the harbor toward the tip of Manhattan Island, presumably intending to attack Fort Amsterdam. And both frigates are clearly in sight now. They carry some 66 guns between them, while here at the fort, the Dutch have only 24 guns, brass six-pounders. We'll get back to Doug Edwards at Stadhuis a little later, but now we take you to the governor's chambers here in the fort, and Ned Kalman.
We're speaking to you from the anteroom right outside the consul chambers where Governor Stuyvesant is meeting with his advisors. Word has just come out that His Excellency will have a statement for us in a very few minutes. Dispatch carriers have been dashing in and out of the consul room all morning. News of the English landing in Brooklyn, of the protest meeting of citizens at Stadhuis, is already in the governor's hands, and no doubt his statement will clarify his own position in this grave emergency. We must realize that what is happening at this moment here in the New World may well be the climax of an all-out struggle between two great European empires for supremacy. The English, of course, based their claim to New Netherlands on Cabot's discovery of the North American mainland in 1498, and they maintain that all this land rightfully belongs within the patent granted to the London and Plymouth companies by the English king in 1607, 57 years ago. The Dutch, on the other hand, point out that the actual discoverer of New Amsterdam Harbor, Henry Hudson, was sailing under the Dutch flag, that they were the first to occupy the territory, and possibly their most cogent argument, that they are here and the English are not. Charles II, just this year, March 1664, decided to press the English claim. He granted all the land between the west bank of the Connecticut River and the east bank of Delaware Bay to his brother James, the Duke of York and Albany. And Colonel Nichols is under express orders from the Duke to take over the colony with force of arms, if need be, at... His Excellency, the Governor, Peter Stuyvesant, has just come out of the Council Chamber. He stopped to talk with the Commander of the Guard. Now, the other members of the Council are filing out of the Chamber now, and they look worn and grim. The Governor himself, however, shows no sign of weariness. His whole figure seems to flash defiance. He's a man of average height, but solidly built. He's wearing breast armor, a doeskin cloak, a brilliant red sash around his waist, and, of course, the most striking feature of all, the famous silver leg, his hallmark. You'll recall he lost his left leg in the fight against the Portuguese when he was governor of the Dutch colony of Curaçao in the West Indies. I'm going to try to get him to speak to us now. Your Excellency, sir, we understand that you wish to make a statement to the people of New Amsterdam.
Yes, and what I have to say is particularly meant for the commander of the English forces, now illegally present in our province.
Yes?
We, the people of New Netherlands, came not into this province by any violence, but by virtue of a commission from the States General of the Netherlands, granted in the years 1614, 1615, and 1616. We came peaceably. We settled peaceably. And we have been good neighbors. Now you come and demand of us our homes, our property, that which labor and sacrifice has given us. We will not give them up. In case you will act by force of arms, we protest before God and man that you will perform an act of unjust violence. As regards your threats, we have no answer to make, only that we fear nothing but what God may lay upon us. All things are at his disposal, and we can be preserved by him with small forces as well as by a great army. This is our last word. We will not surrender. We will not surrender.
Just one question, please. What about the letter you received from Governor Winthrop? Could you tell us what was in that letter?
I will not profane my lips or the ears of the good burghers of New Netherlands by repeating its treacherous contents. Here's the letter, and here's what it serves to be done.
The governor has torn the letter into shreds, torn it apart.
Surrender!
The governor has unequivocally refused to surrender to the English. He has rejected their ultimatum. He has torn up the letter delivered by Governor Winthrop, the letter about which there has been so much speculation. And now it lies in bits on the floor. Almost certainly, this will mean war. And now back up to the parapet of Fort Amsterdam and Bill Leonard.
The English men of war are now just below Governor's Island, not within range yet, but they've crowded on extra canvas. On both frigates, battle pennants can be seen from here, whipping in the breeze. It seems almost only an adverse wind and the strong currents in the bay are slowing their progress, but minute by minute, they're looming larger. They're pressing forward towards Manhattan Island, toward our positions here on Fort Amsterdam. No telling just when the English frigates will move into range, perhaps 10 minutes, perhaps more. We're standing by. In the meantime, there have been further developments at Stadthouse, so we return you once again to Doug Edwards.
Trouble is brewing here at Stadthouse. Up to now, these good burghers were anxious, worried, but in their usual stolid Dutch manner, they kept their feelings to themselves. But now the picture has suddenly changed. Now that they have learned that Governor Stuyvesant has torn up the letter from the English commander, these people are angry. Their faces and manner show that they're exasperated with the action of the governor. We're now in the corridor outside the hall where the meeting of prominent citizens continues. The wording of the remonstrance to Stuyvesant has been agreed upon, and, well, at the moment, it's in the process of being signed by those present in the hall inside. It may be that the crowd here will attempt no overt act until the meeting is concluded, or, entirely possible, any moment may bring the spark that will ignite the temper of the people. And, well, what will happen from that point on is, well, it's anybody's guess, but it won't be pretty and it won't be pleasant. I have here at the microphone with me now a typical citizen of New Amsterdam. His views, I think, will be interesting. May we have your name, sir?
My name is Nicholas Meyer.
What business are you in, sir?
I am a free merchant. I trade in furs. My shop is just in the next street, Hoch Street.
Well, what's your feeling about all that's happening, Mr. Meyer?
Well, my feeling, my attitude is...
He thinks old Sybil Egg is a murderer, and all of us think so, too.
This is my wife. She means Governor Stuyvesant.
His high mightiness, the governor, Peter Stuyvesant. What does he care about us, about the people? What does he care? Oh, he'll fight. Yes, he'll fight. When the English cannons are blowing up our homes and killing us, he'll be safe in the port. Last night, Nicholas, my husband, he told me it's not fighting if we try and stop the English, it's suicide.
He said,
why should we fight the English? What kind of business is it to fight your customers? That's what you said, Nicholas.
I said that, yes.
Oh, you say the English are your best customers, but isn't it illegal to trade with the English here?
Well, yes, but...
It is illegal, but everybody does it. The governor says we must not trade with the English. We must ship all our goods first to Holland on Dutch ships and pay
duty. Yeah, our 5% duty.
So what do we do? What would you do? Oh, smuggle. We're all honest people and we smuggle. We want to have enough to live, we smuggle.
We have to smuggle.
When the English come, then we'll not have to smuggle. We can trade like honest people. All we want is trade, and the English offer us trade. So why should we fight the English?
We cannot fight, even if we want to.
Well, you believe, Mr. Meyer, there's no hope in defending the city?
No,
In all New Amsterdam, there's only 975 shekels of grain left.
975 shekels?
Yes. What about the water shortage? Only 3 wells in the whole town, and 2 of them almost dry. And that's not all. Nicholas, tell me what you told me about the powder for the cannon in the port.
Yes, I have been told from someone who knows that...
That old Silvered Egg wastes so much gunpowder firing salutes every time the English sent a messenger that now there's hardly enough powder left to put up a good battle. Is the truth, Nicholas?
Is the truth.
Well, thank you, Mr. and Mrs. Meyer. I'm sorry, we'd like to hear more, but Don Hollenbeck at Hetzingle has something to report. Come in, Don Hollenbeck.
All work has stopped on the wall. The people have thrown down their tools. They're defying the soldiers, and now in a mass, they are marching toward Fort Amsterdam. The soldiers, too, are beating a quick retreat. They've left this entire northern boundary of the town unprotected. They're heading for the fort as well. To get behind the walls to find some protection, some cover from the English bombardment, which is expected to start at any moment. I'm practically deserted here now, so back to Douglas Edwards at Stadthuis.
I'm speaking now from outside the town hall. The meeting of burghers in Stadthuis is over. The hall is emptying. Everybody, the crowd which was gathered outside and those who were in the hall, everybody is headed down Bruce Street towards Fort Amsterdam. A delegation of 3 has been appointed to present Governor Stuyvesant with a remonstrance or petition signed by 94 of the most prominent citizens in New Amsterdam. The delegation, which is already on its way to the fort, is made up of the 2 leading clergymen of the town, Dominee Megapolensis and his son, and Olaf Stevenson van Kortman, former burgomaster of New Amsterdam and one of its most respected citizens. Most of the burghers have made their way out of the Stadthuis by now. They're... one moment, please. May we have a word, please? Just a word. This is CBS. This is Mr. Balthazar Stuyvesant, the son of Governor Stuyvesant, and has just come out of the Stadthuis. Mr. Stuyvesant, you attended the meeting. You were inside.
Yes.
Well, may we ask your personal attitude on the remonstrance?
I should like to point out, if I may, that while His Excellency the Governor is my father, I am in my own right a citizen of New Amsterdam. I have certain filial obligation to my father, which I have always tried to fulfill. But on the other hand, I have deep and serious obligations to my neighbors, my fellow citizens of New Amsterdam. All of this has placed me in a most difficult position.
Well, we understand that, sir. But...
To answer your question, yes, I signed the remonstrance. And now, please, I must go.
Well, thank you, sir. That was Mr. Balthazar Stuyvesant, the governor's son. He has joined with the other leading citizens of the town in an appeal to his father to avoid war, to surrender the town to the English. This crowd now is rapidly thinning out. Almost everyone is headed toward the fort. Bill Leonard, up on the parapet of Fort Amsterdam, can you see the crowd coming? They're headed down Bruce Street. Come in, Bill Leonard.
Yes, 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 we can just see them coming, Doug. Not only the crowd from Stadthuis, but the men who are working on the northern wall. They're coming this way, too. They're coming down the Hervik, the long highway. From there, from Bruce Street, it seems from every street that leads toward us here at Fort Amsterdam. From every street, the burghers are converging on the fort. We can see that many of them have already gathered on the Markveld just outside the fort. Even from this distance, we can hear their angry roar. But right here, right on the rampart of Fort Amsterdam, the soldiers, the officers, are not looking toward them. They're looking out into the bay toward those two English frigates, which now are only minutes away from coming into cannon range. All eyes are on the snouts of those cannon, which can be seen peering through the portholes on the sides of the men of war, from stem to stern, believe me. Governor Stuyvesant is standing right across from me between two of his 24 brass cannon, 6-pounders. He has one hand on the hilt of his sword. He holds his cane in the other. He's given no sign of even noticing the presence of the crowd below. He seems determined to fight with or without the support of the people he's going to resist. Ned Kalmer has moved from his position at the governor's council chamber and is now in the middle of the demonstration outside the fort. All right, come in, Ned Kalmer.
The crowd here is almost completely out of hand. A few guards before the fort are trying to hold them back, but the crowd is pressing forward, trying to push the soldiers out of the way and shouting and cursing. The delegation of citizens with the remonstrance of Governor Stuyvesant is fighting its way through the crowd. They're trying to get to the entrance of the fort. Some of the younger men are clearing away for them, trying to make a pass, and they've just about reached the gate of the fort. Pastor Megapolensis, the leader of the delegation, has turned toward the people. Now he's holding up his hand, trying to get them quiet. We're up as close as we can possibly get. He's trying to speak. We hope we can pick him up.
Quiet! Go home! All of you, go home! Get your families to safety. Get into the cellars. Find cover if you can.
Where are those silver legs? Make them come out!
No! No, listen! As the Apostle Paul hath said, be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. And he hath said too, let us therefore follow after the things which make for peace. Go home. Compound no further evils here. Your delegation is prepared to offer the remonstrance to His Excellency. It will be heard. No human heart is so base that it cannot be moved by the cries of women, of helpless children. Go home and pray.
Someone has just come out of the fort. I can't make out who it is. I don't
know. It's Nicholas Bayard.
It's Nicholas Bayard, one of the governor's counselors. He's whispering something now to the dominie.
Quiet! Listen to me. Quiet! Listen. We have the letter. We have the letter. It was pieced together by Nicholas Bayard. Do you want to hear the letter?
Yeah! Nicholas Bayard, a member of the governor's council, evidently was able to piece together fragments of the letter which Governor Stuyvesant, you remember, had torn up. And now he's going to read it, I think.
The letter from the English commander says, I do assure you that if Manhattan be delivered up to His Majesty, I shall not hinder, but any people from the Netherlands may freely come and plant there or thereabout.
The English promise not to stop any Dutch settlers from coming to the colony.
Any vessels of their own country may freely come thither.
Ships from the Netherlands will be free to enter the port.
Any of them may as freely return home in vessels of their own country. And this and much more is contained in the privilege of His Majesty's English subjects.
The English commander guarantees them all the rights and privileges of English subjects. In other words, they'll be free to trade with the English. Their property won't be confiscated.
Into the fort!
A
But the people here are demanding to see Stuyvesant.
No!
And if they get into the fort, anything can happen.
Listen to me!
Forward. The Dominie is trying desperately to stop them. He's trying to speak again.
Listen! Don't go inside the fort! Don't try to go into the fort! The guns will be turned upon you! In the name of heaven, don't go into the fort! Wait! Wait for the time!
Go! Go into the fort! Go!
Do it! Do it! See where you are! I should go in! The governor will listen to me!
The Dominie and his delegation have gone into the fort. Gates have slammed shut on the crowd. The soldiers are barring the way, but the people are still trying to press forward. They're being held back for the moment anyway. Bill Leonard is up there on the parapet, so over to Bill Leonard.
The English men of war are past Governor's Island. The Dutch gunners here on the parapet of the fort are at their posts, flaming torches in their hands. And everyone is waiting tensely for the order from Governor Stuyvesant to commence firing. The governor himself is standing next to his captain of artillery. He's peering out at the bay, watching the oncoming English frigates and waiting for them finally to come into range. He hears the roar of the people outside the fort, the cries of those people. He's making no sign of giving in to them. He's a picture of determination, defiance as he's standing there. His breast armor gleaming, silver filigree on his wooden leg I can see sparkling in the sun. And now, up the stairs to the parapet, I can see the Dominie leading his delegation. They're coming right toward us, toward the governor. The elderly clergyman is breathing heavily, but he's gone directly to the side of the governor. We're as close as we can get to them. Now the governor is turned.
Well, Dominie, are you here to bless our venture? Will you lead these brave soldiers in prayer? Well, sir.
I beg you, Your Excellency, in the name of heaven, do not wet your hands with the blood of the innocent. They're crying to you.
Cannon, not tears, will save this colony.
No, I ask you, sir, in the name of humanity, listen to the earnest petition of the people. Hear their remonstrance. You must listen.
Dominie Megapolensis is
right.
Taking out a scroll
Honorable.
Of paper. The governor
we,
turns his back on him.
He's
looking out toward the bay again, toward the English frigates. The clergyman is reading the remonstrance.
In these sad circumstances that we cannot foresee for this fort and city of Manhattan, in further resistance, aught else than misery, sorrow, and conflagration. The dishonor of women, the murder of children,
Captain
and in a word,
Your
the
Excellency,
absolute ruin of 1,500 innocent souls. On all sides we are encompassed and hemmed in by our enemies. Wherefore, we humbly and in bitterness of heart implore Your Honor not to reject the conditions of so generous a foe. Otherwise, we are obliged to call down upon Your Honor the vengeance of heaven for all the innocent blood which shall be shed in consequence of Your Honor's obstinacy. We, the burghers of New Amsterdam, feel certain that Your Honor will conclude, with God's help, an honorable and reasonable capitulation.
Governor Peter Stuyvesant is still looking out toward the English warships, which are now sweeping directly under the guns of the fort. But he has not yet given the order to fire. He just stands there watching like a statue without moving a muscle. Now Dominie Megapolensis and his son go up to places his arm around Stuyvesant's shoulder. Now he's leading him away from the cannon.
Oh, I would rather be carried a corpse to my grave than to surrender this city. But I will. I will.
The governor will not give the order to fire. He will not offer resistance to the English. He turns, is walking slowly away. He's giving up. The obviously untenable military situation, the manifest refusal of the Dutch people to defend their town, must have forced Governor Stuyvesant to make this reluctant and this bitter decision.
Now a white flag has been hoisted over the fort. New Amsterdam has surrendered to the English. Without a fight, without a cannon fired, without a drop of blood being shed, New Amsterdam is surrendering to the English. The people have won out. Stuyvesant has bowed before the will of the people. He's done what he swore he would never do, give up the city without a fight,
without a battle. Now it's all over. It's done.
The English frigates have swept by the fort. They're beyond the fort.
September 1st, 1664. The Dutch surrender to the English, and New Amsterdam becomes New York. You are there.
You have been listening to The Surrender of New Amsterdam in the series You Are There. Today's program was written by Irv Tunick, directed by John Dietz, and produced by the CBS Documentary Unit under the supervision of Werner Michel. Peter Stuyvesant was played by Barry Kroger. Everett Sloan was Dominique Macapalensis. Robert Bryden was Nicholas Bayard. And Irene Hubbard was Mrs. Mayer. Others in the cast included Jack Lloyd and Bert Colin. You Are There is brought to you every fourth Sunday. The next broadcast will be heard Sunday, February 19th, but at a new time at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time over most of these same stations. Next month, at the new time, 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
October 25th, 1854. Balaclava in the Crimea. The charge of the Light Brigade. You are there.
CBS will bring you the earth-shaking premiere of a new opera tonight, an opera written by Alec Templeton, with Charlie McCarthy as a lovelorn singing Bengal Lancer. Templeton himself is a Maharaja.
Well, how strange would that be? Unfortunately, we can't share that one with you, that opera with Charlie McCarthy as a lovelorn operatic character, but it does conjure images, doesn't it? As, of course, does You Are There, taking you to New Amsterdam. How's that song go now? It's old New York. Why they changed it? I can't say. People just like it better.
New York is now New Amsterdam.
Yeah, it was once New Amsterdam, something like that. Anyway, that was You Are There from January 22nd, 1950. Up next, we have a case for Philo Vance. You're listening to Old Time Radio Drama, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
I'm the Ideas Network Director, Cheryl Gasser, inviting you to check out our new Stronger Signal at 107.9 FM. The Ideas Network, where Wisconsin connects.
I don't know, Michelle, sometimes the title suggests that maybe it's giving away the whole
plot
in this case. It might be true. See what you think. The name of this episode for Philo Vance is The Left-Handed Murder Case. See if it plays out that way in this broadcast from January 10th, 1950.
Mother! Mother!
Oh, it's all right, dear. Now, everything's all right. Take it easy, darling. What happened? Did you have a bad dream?
It wasn't a dream, Mother. It wasn't a dream. I saw him. He was at my bedroom window.
Steve?
Yes, I couldn't sleep. I haven't been able to sleep since we broke up. And then I saw his face at the window. Mother, it was awful.
Oh, I know, darling, I know. I'll call the police. Even if you were married to Steve, he has no right to do this to you.
Well, the police won't be able to help us. They'll say I dreamt it. And Steve will deny he was here. The police have been trying to get something on him for months. You know that.
We'll talk about it in the morning. Your father hasn't come home from his meeting yet. I'll leave a note for him in our room, and I'll stay with you tonight. How will that be?
Well, I'll feel much better then, Mom. I'll be sure one thing at least. Steve won't try to kill me. Tonight.
Mm-hmm. She's sleeping now, David, but she was restless all night. What do you think we ought to do?
I don't know, but I'm going to do something. I'll tell you that.
Eat your breakfast, Dave.
I don't want any breakfast. I want to do something to make sure Steve doesn't bother Jan again. And I'm going to do it.
I told Jan last night, and I'll tell you now, David. The police will take care of him.
When? After he kills Jan and makes a nervous wreck of her? Oh, no, Helen. He isn't going to get the chance. I'm going to see to that myself.
Red Queen and a Black King, Steve.
I know. I see it.
Okay, okay. I thought maybe you missed it. Why does a guy play solitaire, anyhow?
One reason, Lefty, is that it gives him something to do when he's alone with a mug like you.
Oh, I'm a mug. Well, look, Steve, maybe I ain't such a mug as you think. Maybe I ain't as stupid as you think, either.
You'd go broke betting on that, Lefty.
Oh, yeah?
That's what I like, intellectual conversation.
Steve, the boys and I have been talking.
I can't imagine anything duller than that.
Wait a minute, wait a minute. You don't know what we've been talking about,
did you?
Sure. Boys and I think maybe you're losing your touch. They think maybe you ought to step down and let me run the gang. With you sticking around to plan the jobs, like always.
Now, look, Lefty.
Hey, boss, take your hands off my collar. You're bending the suit.
I'll bend your neck in a minute. Now, get this, Lefty, and see that the boys here are too. I'm head man in this outfit, and I'm going to stay that way until I decide to quit.
That's the way it is.
That's the way it is. I'll quit when I'm ready and not before.
Okay. And maybe the boys won't like that. Maybe they got their own ideas of how you're going to quit, Steve.
Vance, the singing private investigator. I didn't know you crooned.
I didn't know you were typing the lyrics of a song, Ellen.
Oh, I'm not. I'm writing up the details of your last investigation, the tip-top murder case. And singing helps me type.
If you ever want to get your typing finished, I'd suggest you sing something a little faster.
Now, you didn't come out of your private office just to increase my musical tempo, did you, Vance?
No, I just wondered if the district attorney had called before I came in this morning.
Nope. No word from Mr. Markham. If there had been, I'd have told you.
I thought perhaps you might have been too busy trying to remember the last line of the lyrics of that song you were singing.
Vance, nobody has to worry about a last line of anything when you're around. Oh. Yes? Is there something I can do for you?
Not unless you're Philo Vance.
I'm Vance. What is it?
Oh, hello, Vance. I'm Steve Cayley. I want to talk to you. Can we go into your private office?
Come on. I don't want to be disturbed for a few minutes, Ellen.
Right, Vance.
Come in and sit down, Cayley.
Thanks. You've heard of me, Vance?
Never in a very complimentary fashion.
That was good for my business.
Was good?
That's right. I want to quit. I want to quit while I'm ahead and I'm healthy. I want to leave the gang I've been running around with.
As I understand it, you were the boss. How will the boys feel about your walking out?
Not good. That's what I want you for, Vance. Figure out a way I can get out with my skin in one piece, and I'll take care of you.
Sorry, that's out of my line.
Not interested in making a buck, huh, Vance?
Not the way you suggested. Besides, seems to me I read something about you and your divorce a month or so back. Your wife claimed you were a pretty nasty character.
I was the same character when she married me. I got a little news for you. I'm a little worried about her, and about her old man and her mother. They all hate me pretty much.
Apparently, not without reason. Sorry, Cayley, you've come to the wrong man. If you want to quit your gang, why don't you give yourself up to the police? They'd gladly keep you away from your boys for 5 or 10 years, as I understand it.
I'm allergic to cells, Vance. I tell you what I'd like to do, though. I suppose I give you the dope on the boys. What jobs they've done, all that. Think we could make a deal?
Wait a minute.
Yes?
See if you can get me District Attorney Markham, Helen.
Right.
Ringing the DA in on a deal, huh, Vance?
Yes. You want to give evidence against the boys you've been working with, and he's in that business.
Okay, anything you say. All I want to do...
Just a minute, Cayley. Yes?
Mr. Markham isn't in his office, Vance, but I left word for him to call you.
Thank you.
Well, Vance?
Mr. Markham isn't in. I'll tell you what you do, Cayley. Sometime between now and this evening, Markham will call me back, and I'll set up a date for 6 o'clock in his office. You stay with me until then.
That's all I gotta do. I'll meet you up there, Vance.
I'd rather you were where I can keep an eye on you.
Yeah, I know. I'll see you at Markham's office. Unless...
Unless what?
Unless one of my friends sees me first.
Your friend is late, Vance.
Steve Cayley isn't my friend, Markham. I doubt whether he's anybody's friend. But you're right about one thing. He is late. He was supposed to meet me here in your office at 6. It's 6:20 now.
Maybe he got cold feet.
He seemed to be worried about the rest of him being cold in the event he met one of his enemies. But I don't...
Excuse me.
Of course.
District Attorney Markham speaking.
Hello, Markham. This is Douglas in Homicide. Are you busy?
A little. I'm here in my office with Philo Vance.
Well, how would you like to come up and look at a brand new murder victim?
It's hardly my idea of fun, Douglas. What's happened?
We've got a corpse up here at 300 Roslyn Drive. I think maybe you ought to come up.
I will as soon as I get through here. Vance and I are waiting for a man named Steve Cayley, and after he arrives, I'll meet you up there.
You're waiting for Steve Cayley, huh? Well, Markham, you're liable to have a long wait. The corpse I was telling you about once answered to the name of Steve Cayley.
Who's that?
Me, Mother.
Oh, hello, dear. You're late coming home. Stop off somewhere?
Yes.
Where?
Don't bother me.
David!
I'm sorry, Mother. I didn't mean that. Oh, where's Jan?
I don't know. She's out, too. I thought she might have stopped by at your office for you.
She might have. I wasn't there.
Where were you?
Nowhere. Just walking. And deciding what to do about Steve Cayley.
You mustn't do anything about him, David. He's caused us so much trouble already. Don't make things any worse. Promise me you won't.
All right, Mother. But it's a little late for me to be promising anything where Steve Cayley is concerned.
All right, you guys. All right, dry up. Shut up, I said.
Okay, Lefty, you don't have to get sore.
I don't want nobody to tell me what I have to do.
Okay.
I got something to say to you guys, and I'm going to say it very quick. Steve Cayley is through. He's finished. His nerve is shot. He's going to pack us in. Maybe he's going to turn us in. But we got to do something about that.
I ain't doubting you, Lefty, but how do you know about it?
I just come from his place.
Oh, yeah. What?
Now, listen. You guys gonna listen to me?
Hey, sure, Lefty, we'll listen, but what do we do about Steve?
I'll take care of that. I just want you guys to know what's up. Are you with me?
Sure.
Okay, so you know how we feel, Lefty. Now, who does a job on Steve?
Well, I just wanted to find out how you guys felt before I broke this to you. Any of you guys has to worry about knocking off Steve. That's been taken care of already.
There he is, Markham. Steve Cayley. Somebody did a nice, clean job on him with that knife, right?
Yes, Douglas, that's right. Well, Vance, you see anything that might help us up here in this apartment?
Perhaps. Cayley was killed when the knife was plunged into his heart. The knife went in at an angle, and the hilt of the knife is nearer his right shoulder than his left.
That means something, Vance?
Does to me, Douglas. Markham, let's you and I go back to your office after you call Kelly's ex-wife to have her meet us there.
All right, but why?
Kelly was killed by someone who was left-handed. It's the only reason for the knife to be slanted the way it is. A right-handed person would have had to practically break his wrist to get the knife in the position it's in now.
Yeah, I see what you mean. But why call Kelly's ex-wife down, Vance?
I know he was having trouble with her, as well as with several other people, Markham. We might as well start with her.
Start what with her?
Finding out whether she's left-handed, of course.
Miss Clark, you're using your maiden name now, of course.
Yes, Mr. Markham.
Miss Clark, your ex-husband was killed by a person we believe to be left-handed. Are you left-handed by any chance?
Not that I know of.
Any questions, Vance?
Miss Clark, what glove do you put on first?
Why, the left one, I guess. Doesn't everyone?
I do, Vance.
So do most right-handed people. You had reason to kill your ex-husband, of course, Miss Clark. He told me that himself.
Many people have reason for killing others, Vance. It's a good thing for civilization that that isn't the only thing one needs to murder.
You have a point, of course.
You can't question our child without our being here.
Daddy,
you can't.
Mother. It's all right, dear. We had to come. We followed you from the house after you received that telephone call. What are you trying to do to our child?
I'm District Attorney Markham, Mrs. Clark. Mr. Vance and I were just...
You were just trying to make it look like she killed Steve, weren't you?
Now, take
well,
it easy.
Well, she should have, but she didn't. And don't you try to make it look like she did.
Mr. Clark, we're not trying to make anything appear different than it actually is. You seem awfully sure she didn't do it.
Do you think she did?
Everyone is a suspect until we get some definite information, Mrs. Clark.
She didn't kill Cayley. She couldn't have killed him.
No, Mrs. Clark. Why not?
Because I did. Mother!
Don't believe her. She had nothing to do with his death. I killed him. I killed him myself.
Did you, Mr. Clark? How?
How? Well, I shot him.
How did you kill him, Mrs. Clark?
I shot him. He was tormenting my daughter. I shot him. You've got to believe I did it.
Are either of you left-handed?
No.
I'm not. And what difference does it make? I shot him, I tell you.
I know that's what you'd tell me, Mr. Clark, but Steve Cayley wasn't shot. He was stabbed to death.
What?
Yes, I suggest the three of you go home now and stop trying to alibi for each other. Good night. And what a night. This is District Attorney Markham. A left-handed murder case opened with the killing of gang boss Steve Cayley. Philo Vance is sure a left-handed killer did the job. And our suspects include Cayley's ex-wife, Jan Clark, and her father and mother, although none of them admits to being left-handed. The parents each confess to having killed Cayley, but we're convinced they're merely trying to divert suspicion from their daughter. Vance, remembering that Cayley had mentioned one of his gang named Lefty, has gone to find that individual, and I imagine... Look, Lefty, you sure you got this thing figured out right?
Sure. Sure, I'm sure. Look, you see that traffic light?
Well?
It's got to turn red, ain't it? And when it turns red, a car's got to stop, don't it?
Sure.
Well, there ain't much traffic up here. When a classy car pulls up to stop for the light, you get up on one side of it, I get on the other. We conk the driver, we take the car. We need a classy car for the big job I got in mind.
Okay, if you say so. I don't argue with my new boss.
Oh, he's the new boss, eh? That means he's Lefty.
Who are you?
My name is Vance. I followed the two of you up here.
You did? Why?
Steve Cayley mentioned you when he came to see me just before he was killed. He told me where I could find you. I went there just in time to see you leaving, so I followed you.
So you found us. Hooray.
Lefty, I'm taking you down to see District Attorney Markham. We've got some questions to ask you. We think...
Will you... I figure you don't like questions, Lefty. That's the reason I conked him with my gun.
You practically broke his skull. Good for him. Leave him here. Let's beat it fast. Things are starting to get a little complicated.
You're finding out what a lot of guys find out, Lefty.
Huh?
It ain't so easy to be a boss.
Philo Vance's office, Miss Deering speaking.
Ellen, this is Markham.
The district attorney. I give up. I did it. You got me, partner.
Ellen, this is serious. Something's happened to Vance.
No.
I've just got the report. A man was picked up on the corner of Fort Wade Drive an hour ago and rushed to the Mercy Hospital.
What?
He'd been hit on the head.
What makes you think it's Vance?
The description and identifying cards in his pocket. I'm positive it's Vance, Ellen. I'm on my way up there right now.
So am I. Thanks for calling me. I'll get there right away.
I'll meet you there. I'd like to get my hands on whoever it was that hit Vance. Believe me, I would.
You'd like to get your hands on him. I'd like to get my... nails in him. I'll meet you at the hospital in 20 minutes.
Two hours from now, Jan, and all this unhappiness will be over. We'll be on our way to the coast, and we'll stay away until you've forgotten this unpleasantness.
Oh, thanks, Dad. You and Mother are being swell.
Oh, which reminds me. Mother, How's the packing coming?
Just a few more things, Dad, and I'll be ready to call you in to help me close the valise.
Good enough. Jan, I wish you wouldn't be so nervous. It's all over. Steve's out of the way. For good.
I know, but I can't help what I'm thinking. Dad, did you kill Steve?
We won't talk about Steve. We decided that.
Well, Mother said you were late coming home. You're never late coming home.
I said we
home.
Won't talk about that. Why don't you go see if you can help your mother pack?
Packing's all done, and the valises are closed. What's going on between you two?
Nothing.
Nothing at all, Mother. Well, it looks like we're all set to leave here, doesn't it?
Well, I think that perhaps we ought to let the district attorney's office know we're going out of town.
What for?
Well, they may not like it.
Who cares what they like? We're not criminals. We can come and go where and when we choose. The sooner we get out of here, the better.
Davy.
Yes?
You said we're not criminals and we can come and go as we like. But are you sure one of us isn't a criminal? A criminal who just hasn't been caught up with yet? How does your head feel now, Vance?
Not good enough to listen to you do a chorus of Sally in our alley. I'll tell you that. Nice of you to come up, Ellen. You too, Markham.
We're certainly sorry to see you in this hospital, Vance.
I assure you, it's much more comfortable lying here than it was on the street corner. Though if the truth is known, I don't remember much about lying on that corner.
Take my word for it, the pavement was hard.
Take my word for it, that smack on my head was harder. You sent anybody out to get this lefty person, Markham?
I sent Douglas. He's Sergeant Heath's best man, Vance. He'll bring him in, don't worry. And I'm very anxious to talk to him for two reasons. One of them is the fact that he's responsible for your being in the hospital, and the other is that name of his, Lefty.
I know what you're thinking, Markham. Lefty and a left-handed murderer. That it?
With the motive he has, yes. But supposing it turns out not to be Lefty, Vance?
I have an idea.
Please let it have something to do with me for a change.
It has. You're going to leave here.
Me and my big mouth.
What do you want me to do, Vance?
Get the Clark family up here, Markham. Father, mother, and daughter. I want to see them all in this room.
Suspects can come up, but I've got to go. What's the use of being honest?
You can stay, Ellen. I was only teasing.
Oh.
Markham, you get the Clarks here and see that the heat in this room is turned on as high as it will go. Well, I'll try and solve this case from a hospital bed.
Vance, you've said an awful lot of things that have confused me on an awful lot of occasions, but that last statement of yours makes me wonder just how hard you did get hit on your head.
Worried, Markham?
Yes, I am.
You do as I ask, and you aren't the one who should be worried about me, my friend. It should be either mother, father, or daughter, Clark.
Look, Callahan, I want to do this myself. That door to Lefty's room is awful thin. I can bust it down by crashing into it just once, I'm sure. And Sergeant Heath says I'm to bring Lefty in, so I'm gonna do it. Okay?
Right.
Okay, here goes. Step back and keep your gun ready.
Hey, what's going on out there? Who's that?
Hi.
Okay, you hold it. Hold still, don't move. Oh, there's two of you, huh?
A cop, eh? What do you want busting in here like this, fella? You got a warrant?
No, Lefty, but I got a gun.
All right, don't
do
shoot,
me a
don't
favor
shoot.
And try to
all
argue right, with it, will you? Come on in here, Callahan. We got two passengers for the wagon. Isn't that nice? We'll have company all the way down to headquarters.
It's terribly warm in this hospital room, Vance. Are you sure you're comfortable?
Yes, Miss Clark, but thank you for being so solicitous. I hope Mr. Markham's call didn't interfere with your plans.
Didn't interfere? Of course it did. We were leaving town. Probably made us miss our train.
The last I heard, there were other trains.
Your information is still correct, Ellen. Mrs. Clark, if somebody threatened the safety, perhaps even the sanity of your daughter, you'd take steps to prevent that from happening, wouldn't you?
Of course I would.
And so would I, Vance.
I'm sure you would, Mr. Clark. And I'm sure that Steve Cayley was a constant threat to your daughter.
Look, we've already confessed to killing Steve, but neither you nor the district attorney would believe us.
Of course we wouldn't. You both said you shot him, and Cayley was stabbed. Vance, we're not getting anywhere.
I imagine that's so. Oh, all right. The Clarks can leave if they like, Markham. I guess a case can't be solved from a hospital bed after all.
I'll help you out with your coat, Miss Clark.
Thank you. I'll be ready for it in a second, as soon as I find my gloves.
I'll help you look for them.
Well,
They're not under the bed.
Well, I'm sure they were on this chair. I remember putting them right there on top of my coat. Oh, here they are. They must have fallen on the floor.
Well, we still might be able to make the train if we leave right now. Goodbye, Mr. Vance. I'd like to shake hands with you and wish you a speedy recovery.
Thank you, Mrs. Clark. Well, Mr. Clark, want to shake hands with me?
No.
I will. No hard feelings, Mr. Vance. Pardon my glove.
That's quite all right, Miss Clark. Where's your other glove?
Right here in my hand. Why?
I just wanted to be sure you had it. Because I'm very sure we have you as Steve Cayley's murderer. It's very hard to explain why Miss Clark is our murderer, Markham. A combination of everybody talking and the way my head hurts makes it very difficult.
All right. Quiet, everybody, please. Quiet. Go ahead, Vance.
Well, to begin with, Cayley was killed by a left-handed person. Miss Clark had denied she was left-handed because she realized the mistake she made when she left the knife in Cayley's body at a revealing angle.
Our daughter is left-handed, yes, but she's not a murderer.
Why didn't you tell her she was left-handed?
Nobody asked her.
That's right, Markham. When Mr. and Mrs. Clark came into your office to confess, we didn't mention the fact that Cayley was killed by somebody who was left-handed.
Weren't you too brilliant, though? All right, so I'm left-handed. I put my right glove on first, so you knew that when I shook hands with you. And I did kill Steve. Do you know anybody who deserved death more?
I'm not prepared to say. All I know is that if you had waited a while, I'm sure one of his own gang would have done the job for you. Markham, if you don't mind.
Not at all. All right, everybody, let's leave Vance alone now.
Not exactly alone. I'm staying.
All right, Ellen.
Let's go, everybody. Mr. and Mrs. Clark, and of course, Jan.
Come along.
Goodbye, Vance.
Thanks, Vance. Thanks for everything.
Well, I guess that's that, Vance. How do you feel?
Not too badly, thank you, Ellen. By the way, you know why I wanted this hospital room heated.
I know now. You wanted to make sure the Clarks would take off their coats and their gloves.
That's right. I stalled for a while with unimportant talk to make sure the heat of the room would get them to take off their coats and gloves by themselves, without any suggestion from me that might put them on their guard.
You mean put Jan on her guard, don't you?
I didn't know which of the Clarks was guilty, Ellen. In fact, I didn't know if any of them were. I had to make sure one of them showed they were left-handed before I could do anything at all.
You did plenty, Vance. If you don't believe me, ask Jan Clark. But getting back to Markham's office a minute. What was all that confessing business up there?
Mr. and Mrs. Clark wanted to keep suspicion off their daughter, even though they didn't know at the time that she had killed Cayley.
Oh.
Chances are she tried to get them to murder her ex-husband, making up stories about how Cayley was annoying her. I guess they didn't act quickly enough to suit her.
Uh-huh. By the way, you know, of course, that it could have been Cayley's gang stooge, Lefty, who knocked off the big boss.
It might have been Lefty, of course, but not in view of what happened here a little while ago.
You mean Jan's confession?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you've got something there. And I guess Markham will be able to get plenty on Lefty and the rest of Cayley's gang.
No question about that. Well, as they say in books, this all came out fine in the end.
In the end and at the end of the left-handed murder case.
Thank you.
just making up for some lost time there, at the end of the left-handed murder case, jumping to a few conclusions there, Philo Vance and Company, in a broadcast from January 10th, 1950. And speaking of the facility of Philo Vance solving crimes, well, when we get to Calling All Cars in a minute, you're going to hear a reference to Philo Vance. And we will be getting to Calling All Cars right after this. You're listening to Old Time Radio Drama on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Join the conversation by emailing ideas at WPR.org and like us on Facebook at the Ideas Network.
It's juvenile delinquents who find that crime is not quite so glamorous as they think, and in fact doesn't even pay that well, if at all. But they get in way too deep before discovering those lessons in Crime Does Not Pay. This is Calling All Cars from January 8th, 1935.
Calling All Cars, a presentation of the Rio Grande Oil Company.
The Oakland Police calling all cars. That's an all car broadcast 59. Regarding a murder, Patrolman William Kohler was found shot in the back a few moments ago. Suspects unknown. That's all.
Tonight, Rio Grande makes a sensational new offer. A free gift for everyone who listens to Calling All Cars. Full details at the end of this program. Are you having trouble starting your car these cold mornings? Then try the fastest starting gasoline on the market, Rio Grande Crack Gasoline. The cracking process loses extra energy atoms that flash into action at your first step on the starter. And then you've got power. More power than you need. Power that protects you against driving emergencies. That's what police car performance means. And that's why more police cars in California and Arizona use Rio Grande cracked gasoline than any other brand. Why don't you enjoy police car performance in your car? It costs no more. And remember, at the end of this program, Rio Grande offers you a gift, free. And now, it is with great pleasure that we take you to San Francisco, where you will hear from Bodie Wellman, Chief of the Oakland Police Department. Take it away, San Francisco.
Good evening. Our case tonight directs your attention to the vital problem of juvenile delinquency, one of the most important forces with which police officers are to face. A large part of the crime prevention activities of your police departments is concerned with juvenile work to prevent potential criminals from becoming actual ones. Opposing this concerted effort of your police are powerful factors. First, the natural restlessness of the juvenile adolescent. Second, the present economic situation, which makes it almost impossible for the youth to find work when the lack of funds or of interest separates him from his high school or college studies. And third, the most important, the pernicious practice of a few industries in painting criminals as exciting, thrilling heroes. Where were the sympathies of the youth of the nation when the police of a score of states were hunting for John Dillinger? Who but Al Capone was the great American hero of Prohibition? Too long have our police officers been considered annoying persons who curtailed your right to exceed the speed limit, burn rubbish at unlawful hours, or commit other simple misdemeanors. The policeman shares with the fireman the distinction of being the greatest hero in peacetime life. Daily he stands to give his life to protect yours. For this he receives a modest salary, and in the case of the supreme sacrifice, his widow receives a moderate pension. Beyond this reward he receives, more often than not, the criticism and ridicule by certain factors. It is for this reason that the police officers of the West hailed with such enthusiasm, calling all cars, which, for more than a year, has told the policeman's side of the story. Tonight, I am pleased to bring to you a story of two boys who worshipped well but not wisely at the shrine of the gangster. They set out to emulate their heroes. They conducted their career in true story book fashion, but they could not win. They, as every other criminal who tried to beat the game, discovered that crime does not pay.
It is the middle of June in 1931. School is out, and long, lazy vacation days stretch ahead for Sam Thompson and Ted Mason, two open high school boys. Lying on their backs under eucalyptus trees in the backyard, they discuss their summer plans.
You know, Sam, we simply got to get down to the ROTC camp on the first.
You're telling me.
If we don't get through that summer course, we won't have as good a chance to get appointments to West Point next year.
Oh, I know that too, but how the heck are we going to get down there? My dad told me that business was shot and he couldn't give me any money for expenses.
Yeah, I know. I got the same story at home, too. Gee, $40 is a lot of money.
Yeah.
We could sell magazines or something.
Well, before you sold enough magazines to get $40, camp would be over and school would be started again.
Yeah, that's right.
Gee, I'd do anything to go to West Point.
Anything?
Sure. Boy, just think of it. Wearing those high shakos with the plumes on them and those uniforms with 21 gold buttons and marching across the parade ground in the afternoons with all the pretty girls standing on the side and looking at you. Boy, that's the life.
Yeah. Gee, we've got to get some money.
You know, I've been thinking. You remember how Jaime Waters got his start?
What do you mean?
Well, he stuck up gas stations.
Are you crazy, Sam?
No, I was just thinking.
Oh, I don't want to be no Jaime Waters. I want to go to West Point.
Well, who said anything about becoming a beer baron?
But we do need $40. Well, I'm not sticking up any gas stations.
Well, we wouldn't even have to do that.
What would you do?
Well, we could strip some cars and sell the stuff.
That isn't honest, Sam. I don't want to go to jail.
No, it's easy. Cars store it like they do in the movies. You just pull up to a car in a dark street, unscrew the spotlight and the wind wings and take the tire off.
But that's stealing.
No, it isn't really. Guys that have a lot of junk on their car have it all insured. Heck, they just turn in a claim and the insurance company pays them.
Well, it's stealing from the insurance company.
No, it isn't. Oh, gee, the insurance company'd have millions of dollars. All we need is $40.
Well, if you could figure we're sort of a loan.
Sure you could. Maybe someday we could pay them back.
Yeah, maybe we could. When we get to be captains in the army, that'd make it all right, wouldn't it?
Of course it would. How much money you got?
50 cents.
That isn't enough. We gotta have a gun.
A gun? What for?
For protection, of course. Can't go around stripping cars without protection. And then we gotta rent a car.
Why?
For our getaway.
Yeah, but that costs money.
Well, if you can't get any dough, I know where I can, and I'll buy a gun.
Well, where are you gonna get the money?
Oh, I know where Ma keeps her grocery money. I'll borrow some for a couple of days. And then here's what we'll do. We'll drive down the road.
It is midnight of June 28th. Patrolman Hendrickson is cruising around his beat near the waterfront of Alameda when he sees two cars pulled up side by side at the foot of Pacific Avenue. Hendrickson stops his police car and crosses the street to investigate.
Well, what's the matter, boy? You having a little trouble?
Why, yes.
Yeah, my ignition's gone dead on me.
Ignition's gone dead, eh? Well, do you have to take off the spotlight to fix the ignition?
Well, no, but you see we were...
Yes, I think I do. I see a couple of young punks out stripping cars. You better come along with me.
Oh, no, we won't.
Now, don't pull any gun on me.
Sam, you shouldn't have. Oh, he ain't hurt. I just knocked the wind out of him. A star saved his life.
Oh.
Now listen, copper. Stick up your hands high. Get his gun, Ted.
There you are.
And his hands up.
Yeah.
Now snap his bracelet on. All right, let's get out of here.
Sam, you shouldn't have shot him.
Why not? If he'd taken us in, they'd make jailbirds out of us. Then we'd get thrown out of school and we'd never get to go to West Point. We gotta save our reputation.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
A few days later, Ted and Sam steal a car in Piedmont and go up to a secluded spot in the hills behind Oakland for some target practice.
Boy, am I getting good.
He hit the tree both times that time.
Well, you were pretty good the other night, the way you hit that cop right on the star.
Yeah, well, it's a lucky thing for him that star was in the way, or he'd be a dead copper.
And then you'd be a murderer.
Yeah, well, I don't want to be a murderer, but...
Well, we got to get good with these gats so we can get the draw first.
Yeah. You missed it by a mile.
I guess I need a lot of practice.
Well, we better get it some other time. We only got a gun full of shells left, and we'll need them for tonight.
Okay, let's go. Hey, Sam.
Hmm?
Look at that car coming up here. Looks like a cop in it.
Oh, it is a cop. Come on, let's get out of here.
Just a minute, boys. What's the hurry?
Oh, nothing.
What are you doing up here?
Nothing. Just looking at the view.
Thought I heard some shooting up here, did you?
Oh, no.
Got your driver's license with you?
Yes.
Have a look at it.
Oh, here you are.
Mm-hmm. Where's your registration card?
Why, I don't know. I...
Supposed to be on the steering post of the car.
Yeah, I know.
Who's the car registered to?
Oh, I don't know that either.
Well, I guess you kids better take a ride with me. Get out. Now, I'll just take a look at this license number.
You make a break for it?
He's got your right name.
Well, let's give him the works.
Oh,
it's the only thing we can do. Think about reputations.
Okay.
Let him have it.
Come on, we gotta get out of here.
Wait a minute. I gotta get that book and my license from him.
But Sam, he's lying right in front of the car. We can't go ahead.
Well, we're not gonna back out. We'll run over him.
Oh, gee, Sam.
Get in and quit squawking. The wheels will clear him, all right.
You suppose we killed him?
Oh, I don't know, but... We better get out of town fast.
Yes, sir. What can I do for you?
Get up, Rio Grande cracked.
Okay.
How do you like this crack, mister?
Okay, it gives me first-rate performance.
That's what they all say.
Well, for the love of Pete, will you look at that kid running down the road? If he don't watch himself, he's going to take a nasty spill.
Hey, mister. Hey, hey, there's a dead policeman off the road.
What?
Yeah, no kidding. He's lying right in the middle of the road up at the top of the hill. He's been shot.
Okay, I'll call police headquarters right away. It is a matter of minutes before Inspectors Bill Marshall and Eugene Murphy arrive at the scene of the crime.
Bill Kohler.
Yeah, shot through the head.
25 years he's been on the force, and he has to wind up this way.
Not a single witness, apparently. This will be a fine mess to unravel.
He might have been hit by a stray shot from a hunter.
No, not likely. Look here. Hey, you got one in the back, too. That doesn't make sense that two stray shots have hit him.
And he's been murdered.
Yeah, but by who? Why?
That's the question.
Well, let's figure this thing out. Road curves away less than 100 yards ahead and behind. You got a canyon over here to the right and a hill covered with trees to the left. Well, the job could be done without anyone seeing it.
And a fine chance you'd have tracking anyone. The concrete road doesn't hold any marks, and neither will these pine needles and eucalyptus leaves to the side.
All right. But wait a minute. I'm funny about the position of his car here. It's parked in the middle of the road. Wait until I measure that. About 8 feet from the curb. The Kohler's line with his feet a little ahead of the car and the body practically parallel to the curb.
Meaning what?
I don't know yet. And take a look at his gun, Marshal, while I give his turn once over. Well, there's two of them.
How do you know?
I just found 17 empty shells on the leaves. They were fired from two different guns. Look at the difference in these firing pin marks.
What were they doing over there?
Target practice. There are 4 bullet holes in that tree in the center of the clearing.
Hmm. 4 out of 17 at 25 feet. Not very good shooting.
Yeah. Yet they hit Bill Kohler at 50 feet.
They didn't shoot him from there.
How do you know?
Well, why would he park out in the middle of the street 8 feet from the curb? He must have stopped alongside another car, and they must have been in it, or he'd have pulled up behind or in front.
All right. Suppose they were in the car, and he pulled up and questioned them. About what?
I don't know. But he was suspicious or something. Yeah. He got some information he put down in his notebook.
What was it?
I don't know, because they took his notebook. Must have taken it to conceal whatever he wrote down.
But why did he get out of his car?
He wanted to take down their license number. You can tell that by where he was standing a few feet in front of the car.
Yeah, but they couldn't have shot from inside the car without breaking the windshield.
Well, they must have got out.
What for?
Well, let's suppose he ordered him out and was going to take them to the station in his car. He got out to take the license number and they let him have it.
Well, sounds reasonable. One bullet hits Bill in the face, he wheels around and starts to fall, and the other gets him in the back.
Right.
So then they jump in the car and drive away, but in which direction?
Well, that's easy. Straight ahead.
How do you figure that?
Look at that black smudge on Bill's coat.
Yeah?
Automobile grease. Dirty, dried grease like you find on a crankcase housing.
Meaning?
Meaning they drove right over him and the grease rubbed off the crankcase onto his coat.
You're a regular Philo Vance, aren't you?
Don't call me any dirty names.
No, no offense. Philo Vance is a great detective in these here crime novels.
Oh.
Well, then, Hawkshaw, maybe you can tell me what kind of a car they drove.
I think I can.
Go ahead, I'm waiting.
See that pile of leaves?
Yeah?
The wheels went right over them, ground some of them to dust, and I marked the width of a Ford tire. The fresh track or the wind had blown away.
That's right. The wind's blowing the dust away this minute.
That's okay. We're looking for a Ford with the crankcase grease wiped off. Come on, let's go. Yes, sir. Some gasoline?
You're the man who called us about the murder up the road?
Oh, yeah. You detectives?
All right. Do you remember the cars that have come down this canyon in the past hour or so?
Yeah, I think I do.
How many were there?
Oh, about half a dozen.
How about a Ford with two men in it, going pretty fast?
Yeah, I remember that car. A convertible Ford coupe.
What do they look like?
A couple of young fellows. One had on a red sweater. They didn't wear any hats.
Fine. Got a phone here?
Yes, sir.
Good.
I'll give headquarters that description right away.
Oakland police calling all cars, attention all cars. A stolen car, a Ford Coupe. License 1H Henry 4197. 1 Henry 4197. This car may have been used by the murderers of Patrolman William Kohler. That's all. The next day, the Ford Coupe, the only convertible reported stolen on the day of the murder, is found parked at Fifth Avenue and 19th Street. Murphy and Marshall immediately investigate the car.
Now, I've got a look under that crankcase.
The street's awfully dirty. Watch your suit.
No, I don't care about that. I'm going to try to find out whether this is the car that those hoodlums use.
Hey, Marshall.
Yeah?
It is. The crankcase is clean of grease and one slip down the middle.
What a break.
All right. The next thing is to get this car towed into headquarters and go over it for prints right away.
After photographers have gone over the car for fingerprints and Marshall checks the prints against his record, he reports to Captain Bodie Walnum.
Well, Marshal, how do those prints stack up?
They don't, Captain. We haven't anyone on record with the same prints.
Do the prints you found on the car match with those of the owner or his family?
No, I checked that.
Then the chances are our murderers haven't the record. That makes our job a little tougher.
I've been checking the records also for recent crimes where two young men were involved.
Find anything?
Yeah. Remember Hendrickson over in Alameda being shot at the other night?
Yeah, that's right. They were a couple of young fellows, weren't they?
Yep. I'm going over to Alameda and have a talk with him.
Patrolman Hendrickson recounts his skirmish with death to the officers. After hearing the details of the incident, Marshall hurries on to more pertinent information.
What kind of a gun was it they stole from him?
.38.
Bill Kohler was killed with a .38. Maybe it was yours. You got any empty shells from your gun?
Yeah. I think there's some in this desk. Yeah. Here's a couple of them.
It was the same gun. See the mark this firing pin made?
Yeah.
It left the same mark on the shells we found up in the hills where Bill was killed. What do those fellows look like?
Well, one was medium height with dark, curly hair. He was wearing a red sweater. The other was taller and had his hair slicked back. They were about 17 or 18.
Pretty young to be murderers.
Oh, they weren't hard guys.
Matter of fact, they were a little scared.
What kind of a car were they driving?
A Chrysler Coupe.
Yeah. Did you get the license number?
Well, I didn't have much time to get it, but I noticed it began with a 9F.
Well, that'll do for a starter.
Now I'll have to go over the hot sheet for the past week and see if any Chrysler with a number beginning 9F has been stolen.
Failing to find any Chrysler Coupes with the described license plate reported stolen, Marshall and Murphy direct their attention to the auto rental companies in Oakland. They visit 14 of them with no success. And then they enter the office of the Ute Drive-It on 19th Street.
Well, what can I do for you?
Now, what kind of cars do you rent here?
Fords and Chryslers.
Any of the license numbers on the Chryslers begin with 9F?
All of them do. Why?
We're from police headquarters making a little investigation.
Would your record show who rented these cars at any given time?
Oh, yes. We take a complete record of name, address, age, and occupation of every customer.
Oh, that's swell. You have a Chrysler coupe out on June 28th.
Well, now let me see. Yep, there were three of them.
The fellow we're looking for is about 17 or 18.
Say, I remember him. Here's his name. Ted Mason, and he lives on California Street. He gave his occupation as a high school student. He wore a red sweater, as I remember it.
That's the guy.
Yeah, but how do you know he didn't give you a fake name and address?
Well, I made me show him his driver's license. And because he was underage, I sent him home for a letter from his parents. And when he brought it, I called his mother back to make sure it was genuine.
That's fine. Come on, Murphy. Now we're getting somewhere.
Yes?
Is Ted home?
I know. He's gone to ROTC camp.
Oh, I see. Where is the camp?
Down at Monterey.
Have you a picture of Ted?
Well, why do you want a picture of him?
I see, ma'am, we're police officers.
Police officers? What if Ted got into trouble?
Well, I wouldn't say that, ma'am. He may not be involved at all, but we have to make sure.
Well, I don't know if I should give you a picture.
Well, that'd be best. Is that a picture of him on the table?
Yes, but...
I'll have to take it with me.
Oh, well,
Has Ted a friend, a pal, a little taller than he is? Wears his hair slicked back?
Why, that'd be Sam Thompson. Now, if there's any trouble, he'd be the one you're looking for. He's a bad influence on Ted. I try to tell him to get a new friend, but he just won't listen to me.
Sam Thompson, huh? Where does he live?
Just across the street in that gray house.
Fine. We'll have a talk with his mother.
Well, when can I have the picture back?
Oh, sometime tomorrow, ma'am. We won't want it along.
Well, I do wish you'd tell me what's wrong.
Nothing, ma'am. Nothing to get excited about. We're just making a routine investigation. Good day, Miss Mason.
Good day.
Poor dame. She's just about killer when she finds out her son's a murderer.
And there's no doubt about it, he is. This picture tallies identically with Hendrickson's description.
Hendrickson identifies the pictures of Sam and Ted obtained by the officers as his assailant and photographs comparisons of the firing pin marks on the shells found in the hills and the shells from Hendrickson's gun further identifies the boys as the killers. Marshall and Murphy journey to the ROTC camp at Monterey to place the young men under arrest, but discover that they have not shown up at the camp at all. Circulars are printed carrying the pictures and descriptions of the youth, and these are sent all over the country. A week passes. The scene changes to the little town of Cedar City, Utah. It is noon, and the hot summer sun beats down in glimmering waves on the dusty main street. Two young men saunter along, carrying packs, eyeing the cars parked along the sidewalk.
We've got to steal a car quick.
You're telling me. If the tire hadn't blown out on the other car, we'd be 100 miles further east.
Do you suppose they're looking for us back in Oakland?
No, how could they know we did it?
Oh, cops are pretty smart.
No, they aren't. Gosh, we did everything just like the big shots do it. Changing cars and covering up tracks. See, I guess we're smarter than most crooks.
Oh, hey. Our mothers think we're at camp. Don't you think we ought to go back there?
No, I don't want to hang around home anymore. I'm beginning to like this life. We'll blaze our way across the country to Chicago. Then we can tie up with a mob of big shots where they appreciate good choppers.
Gee, that'd be great, wouldn't it?
Well, it beats going to West Point. Why, we'd be millionaires before we're 20.
Yeah, that'd be swell.
Hey, this car looks okay.
Yeah, nice new Ford. And look, there's the keys in the ignition.
Well, it's ours, then. Pile in.
Just a minute, boys. Not so fast.
Ooh, what's the trouble? We ain't done nothing.
Stick him up and get out of that car.
We just got into rest. We've been hitchhiking from Los Angeles.
Seems to me you fit the description of those kids that killed the officer down in
Oakland? Oh, we never been to Oakland.
What's your name?
Bob Graves.
Yours?
Johnny Fanning.
Keep those hands up. Now, we'll just see what else you got on your hips. A nice 38.
What do you carry this for?
Well, hitchhiking's dangerous. You gotta have protection.
Yeah. Both of you need protection, seems. Two punks are toting a rod apiece. They sure start early these days.
Well, there's nothing wrong with carrying a gun. We got permits down in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I'll just bet you have.
Let's see what else. What's this slip of paper? A receipt from the U Driver Agency in Oakland, made out to Sam Thompson. So your name's Bob Graves,
well,
eh?
Well, you see, I just bought this suit secondhand.
Yeah, I'll bet. Well, boys, I'll have to detain you until I wire Oakland about you.
Well, there's no point in that. We haven't done anything.
Say, but we're heading for the telegraph office. Now, march.
Oakland instructs the marshal of Cedar City to hold the boys for murder. They are returned to the Bay City, and when tests have been completed on the guns found in their possession, they are brought before Captain Wallman.
Well, boys, I suppose you know what you're charged with.
Yes, but it isn't so, sir. We never shot anyone. We never been in Oakland before.
You both deny your guilt?
Yes, sir.
All right, then listen carefully to me. We know you're guilty. Your fingerprints, Mason, were found on the car which ran over Patrolman Colvin's body. You've been identified by Patrolman Hendrickson as the two car strippers who shot at him and stole his gun. Shells from his gun were found near the spot where Kohler was murdered. We've made test shots with the gun taken from you when you were arrested. The rifling marks on the bullets fired in these test shots and the rifling on the bullet taken from Kohler's body are identical. We'll bring this evidence into court and we'll most assuredly win our case. We'll send you to the penitentiary to hang. Now, do you still claim you're innocent?
Gee, Ted, I didn't know cops were so smart. What are we going to do?
There's only one thing we can do, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, boys?
Well, we did it, sir.
But we didn't mean to kill him. That is, we hoped he wouldn't die.
I don't see how you ever found us. I thought cops were dumb.
A lot smarter men than you kids have thought the same thing. Boys, you can't win the game the way you're playing it. I sincerely feel sorry for you. It's too bad that you had to learn your lesson the hard way. But laws are laws. Stick your finger in the fire and it'll get burned. Try stick up some murder and as sure as the sun arrives tomorrow morning, you'll get caught. I guess you boys realize now that crime doesn't pay.
Sam and Ted were charged with murder, assault with intent to kill, and robbery. They pled guilty to murder, waived trial, and on September 18, 1931, appeared before Judge Fred B. Wood in the Superior Court. Because of the California law preventing the execution of minors, they were sentenced for life to San Quentin Penitentiary. The Rio Grande Oil Company offers a gift, absolutely free of charge, to you and to everyone who listens to Calling All Cars. We offer you a year's subscription to Calling All Cars News, a unique new publication devoted to true stories of police, crime, movies, and radio. Your first copy of Calling All Cars News is waiting for you at your nearest Rio Grande service station. Drive in and get your free copy. You are under no obligation to buy Rio Grande cracked gasoline. In this unusual new publication, you will read the truth about Clark Gable, a true story. The inside story of the Gettle kidnapping, an illustrated authentic article. What Warner Baxter thinks about women, written exclusively for Calling All Cars News. Unusual photographs of exciting news events of 1934. Last minute movie news with previews of the latest pictures and an honest theater guide. A list of radio programs you must not miss for January, describing the best bets on the air, including a review of the crime cases to be broadcast this month on Calling All Cars. Get your free copy of this remarkable new publication tomorrow morning. Drive into the Rio Grande service station nearest you. Remember, you do not have to buy Rio Grande cracked gasoline. Just ask for your gift copy of Calling All Cars News, and your Rio Grande dealer will gladly give it to you.
Oakland police calling all cars, attention all cars, cancellation broadcast 59 regarding a murder. Suspects in this case are now in custody. That's all.
Calling All Cars is written and produced by William N. Robeson. This is Frederick Lindsley saying goodnight for the Rio Grande Oil Company.
You may have noticed a little plug there for the product, a little early product placement with a bystander filling up with Rio Grande cracked gasoline. And the investigating cops referring to Philo Vance. How about that? Tying things together tonight. Next up, Rogues Gallery with Dick Powell as old-time radio drama continues here on the Ideas Network of WPR.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Second Century Endowment Fund, a board-designated endowment fund providing ongoing financial support for WPR in its second century of service to the residents of Wisconsin. Support also comes from Club Pilates, offering group Pilates classes for all ages and all skill levels, with locations downtown, the west side of Madison, and Sun Prairie. Information is available at clubpilates.com.
It was sponsored by Fitch's Shampoo and Shaving Cream. And tonight's story, special added attraction, takes us to the Big Top. It seems that just about any radio show, detective show, sooner or later wound up at the circus in some way, and usually involved with acrobats. After all, they're doing those dangerous high-wire acts. And we'll see what the result is for Rogue tonight in Special Added Attraction. Dick Powell starring in a broadcast from January 31st, 1946.
The F.W. Fitch Company, makers of Fitch's saponified coconut oil shampoo and Fitch's shaving creams, presents Dick Powell as Private Investigator Richard Rogue in Rogue's Gallery.
Rogue speaking.
Oh, don't look at me like that. Just because my shirt is half torn off and my face is scratched and my necktie is under my ear, I just walked into a store to buy a pair of socks, right in the middle of a sale of nylons. Oh, women. Long red fingernails, staring eyes, pushing, clawing, all elbows and high heels. Yeah. Anybody know where I can trade my pair of nylons for a white shirt? Oh, well. As I returned from this shopping expedition and was looking on the world at large with a jaundiced eye, I walked into my office and found the suit sitting there, overflowing with a large and robust gentleman with a toothy smile and the manner of a man who was just meeting an old school chum after 40 years of separation. I cringed a little as he rushed happily toward me with a hand like the business end of a claw machine clutching at mine. I'd never seen him before.
Mr. Rogue, you are Mr. Rogue, are you not, the celebrated investigator?
Yes, that's right.
Mr. Rogue, I'm very happy to make your acquaintance, very happy. My name is Price, Pop Price, I'm called by those who know me.
Well, have a chair, Mr. Price.
Thank you, sir, thank you. I have called on you, Mr. Rogue, to retain your services.
Mr. Price, how about starting at the beginning now? When you get through with your end of the story, I'll tell you mine. It'll be a quick yes or no.
Man, a few words that I like. Well, I'll be brief. I realize that you're a busy man, Mr. Rogue.
Yeah, sure, go on.
I am business manager for the Farrington Brothers Circus, the world's greatest show. You've seen the circus, of course, been running here for 3 weeks at the Coliseum.
Well, no, I haven't, but I...
Then you've missed something, sir. You've never seen Carlotta the Magnificent, the world's premier aerialist, the only woman in the world who ever attempted to swing through the air between two flying trapezes, turning four complete somersaults in midair, defying death without even the security of a net beneath her. It's a breathtaking sight, Rogue. Positively breathtaking.
Now, look, mister, if you're selling tickets to the circus,
I came here to employ you, Rogue, in your professional capacity to prevent a murder. Somebody's going to attempt to murder one of the circus leading luminaries during tonight's performance. Rogue, somebody has threatened to murder Carlotta the Magnificent.
No kidding. It's a little unusual for murderers to issue invitations.
Well, here it is, Rogue, the death threat.
Oh, can't get much out of that. Pasted on the back of a circus handbill. Letters cut from newspaper headlines. You'll die during tonight's performance. Now, Pop, isn't that a little dramatic? How was the note delivered?
It was on her makeup table this morning.
Huh? Hmm. Does she have any enemies in the show?
Well, frankly, Rogue, Carlotta is, well, she's the kind of a personality that makes enemies. She's very sure of herself, exceedingly conceited. As a matter of fact, she's what you would probably call an 18-carat dyed-in-the-wool.
Oh, fine.
He's as strong as an ox, as smart as a fox, as mean as a snake, and as brave as a lion. She's 38, but she still considers herself a fatal beauty. As a matter of fact, she's a fine-looking woman, wonderful figure. Big brown eyes.
Sounds like a fascinating character. Who would want to kill her?
In strict confidence, Rogue, almost anybody who's ever had anything to do with her.
Well, that narrows it down a little. Have you told the police about this threatening note?
Yes, I told them, and I've told the newspapers.
Oh, I knew you wouldn't want to leave them out. You know what I think, Pop? I think this whole thing is a press agent's dream. Lots of free publicity.
Believe me, Mr. Rogue, you are wrong.
Tonight only. Tonight only a special added attraction. See the murder of Carlotta the Magnificent, along with the greatest show on Earth. All at the regular price. Oh, Pop, thanks for coming in, but I...
Just a minute, Mr. Rogue. I have here something which I think might change your mind by way of a retainer.
Oh, that stuff. Well, that does help to convince me you're on the level.
Shall we say $500?
That's a nice round figure.
There you are, and here are two passes to the circus tonight. I'll see you there. Rogue, you must prevent that murder.
Well, that's the beginning of our story. We'll continue in just a moment. But now, here's Jim Doyle.
I'd like to say something to the ladies. You know that one of the rules of modern life is perfect cleanliness. For instance, women years ago would be horrified at the thought of washing their hair every day, as many of our Hollywood stars do. But then they didn't have Fitch's saponified coconut oil shampoo in those days. If they had, I'll wager they would have used it frequently. For Fitch's saponified shampoo always leaves the hair lustrous and easy to set. Made from pure vegetable and mild coconut oils, it won't dry the hair or make it harsh feeling. It cleanses thoroughly, too, for it makes loads of fluffy lather even in hard water. This lather whisks away every bit of dust and dirt, leaves your hair fragrant and sparkling clean. Ask for a professional application of Fitch's saponified coconut oil shampoo at your beauty or barber shop, or buy an economical bottle at your drug or toilet goods counter. Look for the bottle with the bright yellow label. And now we return to Dick Powell as Private Investigator Richard Rogue in Rogue's Gallery.
Ordinarily, I wouldn't go to the circus, even if the elephants carried water for me. But when Pop Price, the business manager of the Farrington Brothers Circus, paid me $5 to prevent the murder of Carlotta the Magnificent, I called Betty Callahan at her newspaper and asked her to attend the performance with me that evening. We went early. We wanted to interview the great Carlotta before the big show started.
The circus press agent was in today with a story on that threatening note. Mr. Addison had him thrown out of the office. Don't walk so fast, Richard. Wait a minute. He said no circus press agent was going to chisel any free space from our paper with a moth-eaten gag like that.
Yeah. Well, he's probably right. Excuse me, Sonny. I'll tell you, we'll take him some pink lemonade and some cotton candy when we go back. That'll make him happy.
Oh, sure. I'd better go back with a murder story if I have to commit it myself.
Hey, buddy.
Yeah?
Where do I find Carlotta the Magnificent?
What do you want with her?
We're from a newspaper. We want to interview her.
About that death threat she got today?
Yeah. How did you know about it?
Who doesn't? Everybody in the show is hoping.
You mean they're hoping she'll be killed?
We can dream, can't we? Carlotta's the worst nuisance that ever hit the circus business. I've been in this racket 20 years. And I never knew a dame who could make so many people hate her so much. She's a genius.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. You stutter a little bit there, don't you?
Sorry.
Where do we find this nobody sweetheart?
You're on the right track. Last dressing room in this row.
This circus must think Carlotta is hot stuff. Look at the size of that star on her door.
Yeah. Now, Betty, I'm going to tell her I'm a reporter. Might be able to get more out of her.
All right. What do you want?
Well, we're from the Evening Bulletin.
Oh, you're from the press. I love the press. Did you bring a photographer with you? Come in.
Well, the photographer will be along later.
Oh, please, make yourselves comfortable. This young man is my manager, Frank Davis.
Hello, Mr. Davis. How are you? Here, take this chair, miss.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Davis. Now, you want to ask me some questions, no?
Why, yes, Carlotta, if it isn't too much trouble. Tell me, what is your last name?
I am Carlotta. Do we have to have this young lady here? I would like to talk to you alone.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Miss Betty Callahan. She's also on the paper. My name is Richard Rogue.
You are a very handsome man, Mr. Rogue. You are strong, no?
Oh, I've managed to drag myself around. But let's talk about you, Carlotta.
Could we put this interview off until after the performance tonight, Mr. Rogue? Perhaps we could have dinner, you and I.
You're not very worried about the death threat, are you?
Me? Oh, no. Why should I worry? It's professional jealousy, that is all. Somebody is jealous of Carlotta the Magnificent. Someone who is less beautiful, less talented. That could be almost anybody. They're all jealous, aren't they, Frank?
Why shouldn't they be? Believe me, Mr. Rogue, Carlotta's the queen of them all. I've seen all of them in the last 5 years, and Carlotta, here's the payoff. There's never been anyone within a mile of her.
Oh, Frank. Frank is such a sweet boy. He loves me. But I'm tired. I'm weary. Tonight, I leave the circus.
Well, when did you decide that?
I decided 2 weeks ago. This is my last night as a performer. The circus world loses its greatest attraction after tonight's performance.
Isn't that tragic?
Carlotta, does Pop Price know of your decision?
Price? Oh, of course he knows.
His heart is breaking. What will his show be without Carlotta Magnificent? What will it be? Answer me.
I don't know.
It will be nothing.
Yeah. Well, now look. What did you do when you found that threatening note?
I turned the note over to Price. He turned it over to the police. Have you seen my act, Mr. Rogue?
No.
We're going to see it tonight, Carlotta.
Oh, I am sensational.
Well, Carlotta, that note you received was lying here on your makeup table when you came in today, right?
Yes. Young man, have you ever tried to do 4 somersaults 100 feet in the air?
Me?
Without a net?
Oh, now look, Carlotta, I want to know about that note. You don't want to get killed, do you?
Look, I take a big swing, then 4 somersaults. Then I grab the trapeze on the other side. It is impossible. Unless you are me.
This I have to see, Carlotta.
Feel that muscle, Mr. Rogue.
Sure. Wow. Hey, that's something. Yes. You're as strong as an... Well, you're very strong.
Yeah, and I've got the scars to prove it, haven't I, Carlotta?
Yes. Frank and I were scuffling this morning. Look, open your mouth, sweetheart. There. A front tooth. I knocked it out. He is scuffling with Carlotta, who could tear him to pieces.
Well, she didn't mean to do it, Mr. Rogue. We were just kidding around.
But I'm very feminine. I have a lovely figure. I dress very quietly on the street. You'll be proud of me when we go to dinner tonight, Mr. Rogue.
Oh, I'm sure I will. Look, Carlotta, I hate to be practical, but aren't you a little worried about the note? I mean, Pop Price is worried.
Of course he's worried. He's afraid I'm leaving his show.
You're on in 10 minutes. Think.
Pig.
Don't pay any attention to him, Carlotta. I'll take care of him for you.
Well, we'll have to hurry to our seats. We don't want to miss your performance.
We'll be watching you, Carlotta.
You will hurry. There will be a tremendous crowd tonight. This is Carlotta the Magnificent's last performance.
Oh, kind of hard on the public, isn't it?
Of course. I will see you after the performance, Hanson.
Thanks for coming back to see us, Rogue, and you too, Miss Callahan.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll see you later tonight, Carlotta.
If she should live so long.
You know, Betty, I sometimes wonder if she really wants to talk to me after the show.
You know, Richard, I feel that if I knew Carlotta the Magnificent just a little better, I'd kill her myself. She was absolutely brazen the way she flirted with you.
Oh, now.
And that Davis. He's young enough to be a son. She's a brazen flirt.
Well, you could take some lessons from her, Betty.
What?
That's a girl who knows what she wants.
On second thought, the two of you should make a wonderful couple. You could just sit around and talk to each other about each other and lead a life of great bliss.
Well, I'll say one thing for Pop Price. He figured us in for some good seats. We're practically part of the show.
Oh, I love circuses. I think they're exciting. Don't you, Richard?
Sure. The first honest work I ever did was carrying hay for the horses when the circus came to town. Come to think of it, I guess it was the last honest work I ever did, too.
Oh, Richard. Well, you can be an animal fan if you want to. Personally, I like the clowns.
Oh, I like clowns, too.
Look, Richard. Look at that clown with the camera. Coming around here. See him?
Yeah. You mean the one dressed like a woman?
Look at that hat. Isn't it ridiculous?
You've got one just like it, haven't you?
Oh, it's just like a man. The hat that clown has on has real fruit on it. Apples and oranges and grapefruit. Oh, look.
At least the hat's practical. Did you see Mario grab that apple off and take a bite out of it?
Yes. Mario? Is that the famous Mario?
Why don't you look at your program? I paid 2 bits for it.
Oh.
That clown in the red, white, and blue outfit with the putty nose and the big shoes is Mario. The highest paid clown in the world.
Ladies and gentlemen, your attention, please. Your attention, please.
The
greatest show on earth proudly presents the most sensational attraction ever to be seen on any stage, in any circus, or any theater. America's premier circus proudly presents the greatest aerialist of all time.
Carlotta must have written that
himself.
I call
your attention to the fact
jealous.
In the performance of our astounding and death-defying feat, no net protects this intrepid artist from certain death in case of a mishap.
Good.
Ladies and gentlemen, the feature attraction of this great show, Carlotta the Magnificent.
Well, there comes your girlfriend. She's climbing up to a trapeze.
Oh, a beautiful figure, hasn't she?
Lovely, for her age.
Now, kitty, 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 kitty,
shut
kitty.
Up.
Huh? Carlotta the Magnificent is ready to go. You'll soon find out whether you're covering a hoax or not.
You don't think there's any doubt of it being a hoax, do you?
Baby, I'm not sure of anything.
Well, I wish this were over.
So do I. Well, there she goes, out on the trapeze.
So she takes a big swing.
Looks like a tough way to make a buck, doesn't it?
Well, why doesn't she jump?
She's gathering momentum. Here come the somersaults, Betty.
Richard, she's falling. Get on, Richard. Let that go.
That note meant business, Betty. Come on. We've just witnessed a murder. We'll return to our story in just a moment. But now here's Jim Doyle, the man from the Fitch Company, who wants to say something about one of his favorite subjects.
That's right, Dick. Fitch's No Brush Shaving Cream is a favorite subject with me because men are always so pleased with it after they've tried it. Fitch's No Brush combines three different shaving ingredients into one easy-to-use cream. One of the ingredients, a special skin conditioner, helps prepare even a tender, sensitive face for a solid comfort shave. Fitch's No Brush also has a creamy, non-greasy texture. It helps the razor do the job in a hurry, even if your beard is tough. When you've finished your shave, your face feels cool and refreshed and smooth as can be.
For men who prefer lather, there's Fitch's Brush Cream. It gives lots of rich, dense lather that stays moist all during the shave. Rinses off easily, too, leaving your face feeling smooth and pleasantly cool.
Join the thousands who have found shaving pleasure through their switch to Fitch. Both Fitch's Brush and Fitch's No Brush shaving creams contain the special skin conditioner for sensitive faces, and both come in handy 25 and 50 cent sizes. And now, Dick Powell as Private Investigator Richard Rogue in Rogue's Gallery.
I get invited to a lot of things, but this was the first time I was ever invited to watch a murder. As I sat there in my box seat at the circus and watched my self-elected dinner date, Carlotta the Magnificent, tumble to her death, I felt a great emptiness. I would probably have shown how I felt with much more gusto if Betty Callahan hadn't been practically tearing my arm off. The whole place was in a turmoil. And it took Betty and me quite a while to get down to where Lieutenant Urban was standing not far from the body.
Please clear the arena. The upper exits and leaving. Use the upper exits, please.
I've got to call my city desk.
Well, go ahead, Betty. You can find a phone someplace down around the business offices. I'm going to talk to Urban. He looks a little upset.
I'll be right back.
Right. Take it easy now.
Yes, I'll hurry.
What are you doing here?
Well, I'm working for the corpse.
What do you mean, working for the corpse?
Well, it's simple. I was hired to keep this from happening.
Who paid you?
Pop Price, the head man of this outfit. How'd it happen?
Well, there are two 38 caliber bullets in the body. Somebody did some nice shooting.
Oh.
while the drums were rolling to cover up the noise, and the arena was darkened except for the spotlight on the victim.
Wow,
that's very nice planning.
Stay right here, Rogue. We may want to talk with you later.
Okay, I'm not going anyplace. Hello, Price.
Mr. Rogue, may I speak with you a moment?
Are you Price, business manager of this layout?
Yes, this is horrible.
Where were you when it happened?
I was standing in the entry back there. I was worried.
Oh, you were? Of course he was. He'd been warned that Carlotta was going to be killed at this performance.
I can handle this, Rogue.
You don't think I had anything to do with it, do you?
She was leaving the show. This was to be her last performance, wasn't it?
Yes, at least she intended to quit. She was always threatening to quit.
And this time it looked like she meant it, eh? What would happen to your show if Carlotta left it? She was the star, wasn't she?
Yes, she was the stellar attraction.
Uh-huh. So you'd have been in trouble. She was spotting you, wasn't she? And you took this way of getting even.
That's a good theory, Urban.
Thanks. Who was with you when it happened, Bryce?
I was alone.
Careless of you. Somebody punched a hole in your meal ticket. Now, don't leave the premises. I want to talk with you later. Where's the dead woman's manager? I want to talk with him.
He's in her dressing room. His name is Davis.
Oh, he is, eh? Well, we'll call on him there. Come on, Rogue.
Rachel, wait for me.
Well, hurry up, Betty. Urban marches on.
All right, Davis, we just want to ask some questions. You have been associated with Carlotta for 5 years. Who would have wanted to kill her?
Believe me, Lieutenant Urban, if I knew, I'd murder them. You don't know what Carlotta meant to me. I loved her. She had a lot of enemies, but...
Just name off a few of them, will you?
Well, she had a run-in with the animal trainer, Cliff Stewart, the other day, and a big fight with Mario the Clown last week, and she and Pop Price weren't getting along very well. She threatened to choke him to death a few nights ago, and she was threatening to quit and taunting him about it. Well, it must have been one of them. They didn't understand Carlotta. They didn't know how to handle her. One of them killed her.
Davis, did she leave a will? Who gets her money?
She had no money, Mr. Rogue. She spent it as fast as she got it. Sometimes a little faster. I tried to get her to save some money for the future. But she was too big-hearted.
If she didn't have any dough, how come she was quitting $1,000-a-week job?
Her doctor ordered her to take it easy for a while. Her heart was acting up. I had it all fixed for a 3-month rest in Mexico City. That's what she wanted.
We found the gun, Lieutenant Urban.
Where?
Right by the third ring. The gun is a Smith & Wesson, 38, and there were 2 ejected shells laying right by it.
Well, it must have been dropped as soon as it was fired.
That gun belongs to Mario the Clown.
How do you know?
I have seen it in his trunk 1,000 times. So has everybody else in the circus. It's his, all right. It's got his initials on the butt.
Mario, eh?
That murdering skunk. I'm going to kill him for this. He did it. He shot Carlotta.
Mario was standing in the ring, right about where the shot was fired, just a few minutes before the murder.
That's right, Richard. We were watching him when the house lights dim for Carlotta's entrance.
Yeah, that's his routine. I'm going to find him and...
Davis, take it easy. I think the police can handle this.
This is a personal thing. Give me that gun.
Cut it out, Davis. Now sit down.
Take it easy, Davis.
Now, where's Mario's dressing room?
Right next door.
Come on, Urban. Let's go see how funny this clown really is.
Mario! Mario! Open up! This is the law.
You know, he just may not be in there.
We'll see.
Oh! Richard! He's dead.
No, I don't think so. He's been chloroformed. Smell it? Look, here's the bottle. He's still got the saturated cloth in his hand.
Well, don't stand there waving at my face.
Why would he chloroform himself?
Well, what makes you think he did?
Murderers do funny things. Come on, let's get him out of here. Help me lift him, Rogue.
Now, wait a minute, Urban. Why don't you wait until he comes out of it? The way you're going at it, he'll be in the electric chair before he wakes up.
You saw him right there at the edge of ring number 3 just before Carlotta was shot, didn't you, Rogue?
Yes.
Anybody else around him?
No.
And Carlotta was shot with Mario's gun. That's all I need. I'm taking him down and booking him for murder.
Betty, I bet if your paper prints that story the way you see it, you're going to live to regret the day the printing press was invented. Urban's jumping the gun. Nobody ever went to that much trouble to frame themselves to the chair.
Look, Richard, I'm your greatest admirer and all that, but you're just being bullheaded. Nobody but Mario was near the spot where the gun and the spent cartridges were found. Pure logic proves that he's the guilty man.
Somebody might have been impersonating Mario.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Hey...
What are you doing?
I'm going back to the circus. There's one piece of evidence that everybody forgot to check.
I'm not at all sure I like being alone in the menagerie at midnight.
No, well, hang on to my hand. We'll be in the main arena just a minute.
Thank goodness there's some lights in the arena.
Yeah, it's an awful looking place in here, isn't it?
I don't imagine we're improving it much.
No. Okay, all right, now here's the third ring.
Mm-hmm.
We were watching Mario. He was right about here, wasn't he?
Yeah, over this way a little, I think.
Well, it's bound to be here someplace.
Richard, what are you doing down on your hands and knees?
I'm looking for a clue, baby. A clue that's going to send somebody up for murder. I'll show that urban guy how a really sharp investigator works.
Oh, let's get out of here, Richard.
Well, it's got to be here someplace.
Well,
someplace. I've got it, Betty.
Drop it, Rogue.
Huh?
Drop it.
Huh? Oh, okay. Okay, Davis. I always do as I'm told when I'm talking past a 45. You killed Carlotta, didn't you?
Yes, but I'm not going to be arrested for it. Nobody I can prove I did it but you, Rogue. And you're not going to live to tell it. And neither is Miss Callahan here. All right, Miss Callahan, get over here. Over by Rogue.
Oh.
You think you can get away with killing us here?
It's worth trying, isn't it?
Well, okay.
Look out, Betty! Stop!
I didn't have anything to lose, so I rushed him. I may not be as strong as Collada was, but I was stronger than Frank Davis. And I had the advantage of some judo I'd picked up during a date with a Hatchek girl. I got the gun away from him and turned him over to Urban. He admitted killing Collada. She was quitting the business and demanding an accounting of her cash. Davis had gambled most of it away. He knew Mario's routine, so he slipped him a Mickey, borrowed his costume and his gun, and took his place in the arena that evening. And you know, when he was impersonating Mario, and Betty and I watched him take a bite out of an apple, he got off another clown's hat, remember? Well, I found the apple, and that's what convicted him. That front tooth Carlotta knocked out of his mouth gave him a kind of an individualistic bite. It showed up as plain as the nose on Durante's face and the part of the apple that was left. Smart work, huh? Well, they executed Frank Davis for the murder of Carlotta the Magnificent. She was quite a girl. Quite a girl. Betty didn't seem to like her, but, well, after all, women are all alike. Everyone you meet is different. You know what I mean? This is Dick Powell again, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you enjoyed our story tonight. Ray Buffum wrote it. Leith Stevens composed and conducted the music, and Dee Engelbach produced and directed. But don't forget, you've all got a date with us next Thursday night. We have a story for you about a girl, a boy, and a gun. So make a date with us, will you? Thanks for listening, and now here's Jim Doyle.
Be with us again at the same time next week. Oh, and by the way, be sure to see Dick Powell in his latest RKO picture, Cornered, at your local theater soon. Remember, tune in again next Thursday, same time, same station, when you will again hear Dick Powell as Private Investigator Richard Rogue in Rogue's Gallery. Remember, if dandruff is your problem, ask for Fitch's Dandruff Remover Shampoo. It's the only shampoo made whose guarantee to remove dandruff is backed by one of the world's largest insurance firms. No other shampoo can make this statement. Ask for Fitch's Dandruff Remover Shampoo at your drug or toilet goods counter, beauty or barber shop. Fitch is spelled F-I-T-C-H.
A story about the obnoxious acrobat Carlotta. And, you know, if you're an acrobat and depending upon others for your safety, it is a good idea to be very nice to those people, at least. That was perhaps one of the morals in Special Added Attraction, Rogues Gallery, starring Dick Powell from January 31st, 1946. And that's it for Old Time Radio Drama for tonight. I'm Norman Gilliland. A pleasure having you with me. And I hope that next time you can be with me too, right there by the glow of your radio. This is the Ideas Network of WPR.